December 13th, 2013. We recorded an episode 362 called The Day the Music Died. It was a dark episode because we were talking about Nintendo's US sales, just how everything was a disaster. I've come to talk with you. This week, we got a lot of news from Nintendo. And it's the kind of stuff that episode titles like The Day the Music Died 2 comes out of. Because this week, Nintendo announced their newest Humble Bundle, Friends of Nintendo. I'm joined this week to talk about it by Mr. Guillaume Veillette.
Hello. I'm a friend of Nintendo too, by the way.
Yes. And because half the show bailed on me this week, I'm also joined by our friend, Dr. Jonathan Metz.
Hi, I'm a friend of Radio Free Nintendo.
I suppose that does make you officially friend of the show, which is a weird thing to call it out now.
If you'll have me.
Well, we did, apparently, because you're here. I'm not joined by Greg.
Are you saying you had me, James?
Have.
You had me at...
I had you, you I had you at Hey John,
hello
are you available?
And welcome.
I did. I'm not joined by Greg, who's busy watching the Bills making another mistake. And John, who canceled on us at the last minute. It was going to, you know, they can't prove this wasn't the case, but I was going to let John host this week, which is what Greg has been wanting. But since they're both not here, I guess he doesn't get to host. It's a shame.
You know, I just want to say I'm honored to be Greg's substitute for draft week, a time-honored tradition here on the show. I think this is my first time getting to serve in that role.
Of Greg watching the sadness happen. Greg, if you're listening right now, you know I'm right.
You know, maybe this is the Bills' year.
No, that's not true. You may as well say it's the Redskins' year. That's not happening. So obviously, Nintendo had some announcements this week that are going to weigh heavily on this show. And in an effort to not just be a bummer of a show, we're going to do the news first. And we're actually not going to start with Nintendo's quarterly announcements. We're going to do this chronologically, I guess. It's the only justification I can have for starting with the Humble Bundle. But Nintendo did another Humble Bundle. They did one about, what, 5-ish months ago? Maybe a little more recently than that. In North America, where they had a bunch of indie games that you could get for an obscenely cheap price. And this time we did it again. And actually, it includes Europe and South Africa in their list.
Nice.
So you can get a Retro Rampage DX, Affordable Space Adventures, and Shantae for literally $1. $1.
Mm-hmm. I mean, you should spend more than that.
Yes, but I mean, for $1, you get those. That is an obscene price.
Yeah, but lest we forget, this is mostly for charity, right? Some of the money goes to the game developers.
Absolutely.
Most of it goes to charity. Don't be a cheapskate. You're going to get a great deal regardless. Even if you spent $20 on this bundle, you'd still be getting a great deal. So don't spend $1 for this stuff. That's basically...
The developer of Affordable Space Adventures went on record saying like they wouldn't deep discount their game for a long time. And it's like a $20 title. So
yeah, it is.
Right there.
I'm only pointing it out because that is probably the most insane intro Humble Bundle I've ever seen.
It's
like the opening base price, that's got to be the craziest one I've ever seen.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But you have the floating number, which is like the more than average, and you get Freedom Planet, Rhythm Thief, and the Emperor's Treasure on 3DS, which is a great fucking game. Citizens of Earth, which I think might still be broken.
I think they patched it.
Did they finally patch it? Yay!
On 3DS, anyway.
And then a theme for your 3DS for whatever reason. And then if you go over 13, you get a weird port of Super Street Fighter 4 for the 3DS and Darksiders 2. So basically you get some weird like launch title ports.
So yeah, make sure to pay $12.99 and not a cent more.
That's right. You show Capcom and also that bankrupt company who's boss.
Yes.
But like that's a pretty solid bundle. And I'm glad to see that Europe got to get in on this one. It's cool. Like I'm super interested in getting this, even though I own at least a third of these games. Like the other ones are worth having, and you know, Affordable Space Adventures is it's a $20 game, and it's totally worth it. Mm-hmm. You can get it for $13 and get a bunch of other stuff for free. Think about it that way. It's on sale for $13 for good cause.
Yeah, basically, I already own Citizens of Earth on Wii U and then never played it because I guess I play my RPGs more on the on portables. So I actually bought the bundle to get the portable version. Plus, Freedom Planet seems alright for a game based on Sonic. And,
for a game based on a terrible franchise, yeah. It's okay. Yeah.
And Retro City Rampage, I guess, maybe.
Yep. It's a cool game. A cool game.
Yeah, I like that game. I haven't played the 3DS version, but I played on Vita, which is, you know, I think the 3DS version is actually better in a lot of ways. They added some new features and stuff, so. And I believe it's also deluxe. Optimized for the new 3DS. You can use both joysticks, but also there's some performance upgrades or something weird.
Hmm.
Yeah. I mean, you don't have to have it on new 3DS. It's basically a retro-style indie, so I'm sure it runs perfectly fine on the original, but that's kind of a neat wrinkle. But I mean, that guy put in some extra effort, which is nice because it's one guy, you know.
Yeah.
Cool.
So is the price, like right now, as I'm looking at it, the average price that people paid is $9.76. And I'm kind of wondering, like, do we have data on whether that's a high average or not? Like, because usually the bundles that I've looked at, they were mostly indie games. So the average was maybe, I don't know, like around $5 or $6 at most.
Mm-hmm. That seems on the higher end of the ones that I've looked at, I would say.
Mm-hmm.
I don't have any numbers in front of me, but yeah, it does seem higher than I'm used to seeing.
Mm. Yeah, probably people just jumping on a good deal because there's not that many on the Wii U, right? Like, the Nintendo controls the eShop, although, well, they exert less of their influence on the eShop than they did on the WiiWare, but... Mm-hmm.
There will be no sales.
Yeah, exactly. So
Nick's Quest will cost the same price to eternity.
Yeah, I would guess that this this deal seems really good, the bundle, and seems to have a lot of different game creators involved, and it's not been that long since the last... Was it E3 last year? Or right before E3?
I think it was either right before or right after. I can't remember.
We were talking... I get a little confused because... I got to meet Damon Baker actually at last E3, and we talked to him about maybe it was about those E3 indie demos that they did.
Yeah, probably.
And then he was back on the telethon, and I was listening to that live. And so I feel like I talked to him twice last year, even though it was actually just the once. Maybe he was telling it later, but I just remember we were asking him about this stuff and how they set it up. And
yes.
But it must have been a huge success if they're doing another one fairly soon after, and it seems like this one's also doing really well. I think it just shows you there's a thirst for this stuff, and also that probably there are a lot of people out there who are curious about these indie games on Nintendo systems, but also don't feel very comfortable paying full price for them, in part because... You know, maybe they got burned by WiiWare a few years ago. Maybe they feel like Nintendo's digital content policies are not very good, and so they only feel comfortable buying them at cheap prices. I could understand that. You know, you can't get a refund. You can't necessarily transfer it to another system. You can't share it or anything like that. So, but I think obviously there's a demand for people to play this stuff and to check it out. So it's good for everybody, really.
It's great if you're hosting a podcast every week and you need a game to talk about. Like, this is amazing.
So I'm looking at the top contributors for this, and just like last year, Damon Baker, anyway, is the top contributor with $250. Wow. Number two is number one Wii Chair fan, who paid $180
for these
games.
Is that Tyron?
That might be Carmine.
Oh no!
That is actually
it's gotta be Carmine.
There are probably only like three people in the world who would claim to be or would want other people to know that they feel that they're the number one fans of Wii Cheer, and Carmine is definitely one of those three people. So.
Oh no!
The dirty secret of number one Wii Cheer fan is that there's no number two, really.
Carmine,
it's gotta be
we
Carmine.
Can help.
What a guy!
We can help.
What a great guy.
We can help you. just reach out. We'll find help. We do this together. He is an amazing human being in a lot of ways. Very, very generous. But wow.
This seems like exactly the kind of thing Carmine would go in and pay probably way more than what these games are actually worth, even if you bought them at full price. That seems like something he would do.
I mean, we've seen his generosity in play during the telethon. He's contributed money to our E3 expenses before. He's a super, super nice dude.
Yeah, he's a lovely person. He has really bad taste in games, but
really amazing taste in games.
Yeah, but he's also a defender of the downtrodden. I think it's fair.
He is.
Yeah.
Anyway. I mean, there was the joke we had the recommended for fans, not recommended. We just needed a fourth criterion just for his games. Uh-huh. It's like these are Chiron recommended games.
Only for Chiron, Carmine, same guy.
Right.
Anyway, yeah. Humble Bundle. Nice.
I'm actually excited about this list more so than the last one. I haven't bought it yet, but I'm curious what the quote more games coming soon is.
Mm. Yeah, I haven't bought it because I already own too many of these. Some on different platforms, but you know, like I already have Affordable Space Adventures, and I've played it all of about 2 minutes. So I need to just go do that.
Yeah. It's so much more fun with the second person. And then if you have a third person, it's actually when you get the third person, it crosses into just like, I want to kill all of you territory. Mm-hmm. But with two, it's great. I already own Super Street Fighter 4. I already own Darksiders 2. I already own Rhythm Thief. I mean, but like, I can give those games away. I want more people to play Rhythm Thief. Like that. To me, there was that weird stretch in the early 3DS life cycle where other companies were like, we can figure out what makes Layton work and do that. And this is the only one that I think even got in the neighborhood. Like, but it, in part because they didn't make a game about a professor of archaeology who studies puzzles with a younger steward who is also their ward and is also their assistant. I'm looking at you, Konami. And they went and like made their own thing.
What was that game called? Like Professor
Dr. Lautrec.
Dr. Lautrec.
He wasn't a professor of archaeology. He was a doctor of archaeology. It's totally different. It's almost unbelievable. Most unbelievable press release in the history of my experience.
Maybe it's for the best that Konami doesn't make games anymore.
It's so bad. But like, it's such a cool game with its own style, and it just kind of works at the same level. It's just not as good of a game as a Layton game.
So yeah, so people, like, if you haven't jumped on this offer yet and you're like dreading the idea of inputting what, like 8 or 9 16-digit codes, you know, like looking on your screen and typing that on the gamepad or the 3DS, you can actually just copy and paste them into various websites. Like there's, and for whatever reason, there's two of them. And some people have told me on Twitter that one of them worked and the other didn't. And some other people, like, it was vice versa. Like, it was. So what worked for me was eShop, then Nintendo.net, /redeem, sharp. For some other people, what worked was ec.nintendo.net, /redeem, sharp again. So
these URLs are actually the titles of the next two Fire Emblem games.
Right.
Spinoffs, to be fair. We talked about this during the last Humble Bundle. Like, that was what made this even remotely workable for me, is that I could just paste these damn things in and I was done.
Mm-hmm.
And then, like, they just downloaded directly to the 3DS or the Wii U, depending on what system they were for. And then I had games to play. It is a very enjoyable experience to just turn on system and play game.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. Downloads automatically for you. It's fantastic. I actually got the second URL wrong. ec.nintendo.com/redeem-sharp. Carry on.
Redeem it very sharp. Don't redeem it flat or double flat if you're a fucking monster. Just sharp.
Rest, James. Yep. Rest.
Yeah. I think that's probably gonna do it for us. It's a cool list. I'm curious to see what the other games are gonna be. I'm worried it's gonna be more 3DS home menu themes, but. Hey, here's your another Pokemon theme, you dirty monsters. Like, but
No. Nintendo would not put their own precious themes on a Humble
that's
Bundle.
That's true.
You're going to get the Friends of Sonic, you know, background.
Sonic has no friends.
Sonic begs to differ. He's got lots of friends. He wants to you
that's
to meet
the
them
problem.
All. So yeah, you're going to get a bunch of third-party 3DS themes. It's going to be awesome.
Great.
I bet there's more to it than that.
I simply cannot wait for my Mock Rider theme or whatever. What's the, it's not Mock Rider, my, shoot. Oh, well. I said that one of the Sega Classic 3D games. I'm going to throw that
hang
one out
on,
there.
Super Hang On.
Yeah, my Super Hang On theme. Great. That will certainly save us from the bad news we're about to talk about now. Because Nintendo had their annual, it's a quarterly, but this is the end of the fiscal year investors briefing slash report out slash whatever terminology you want to use for it. And it's mixed news if you're a Nintendo investor. I mean, lead off, they made money. They made not a lot of money. They made, you know, multiple million dollars. It was like $100 and something million, which isn't a huge amount of money for that company, but it's a profit. Like, at some point, profit is profit. They announced some organizational restructures, not least of which is they're going to create an oversight board for auditing purposes. I don't understand Nintendo's internal auditing policies, so I'm not going to put on the business cap and try to explain to you what the role of this board is. But
I don't think I want to know their internal auditing policy.
Well, I think the fact they set up a board is an argument that they didn't have one.
Okay, well, sure.
It's probably a move towards less of a cult of personality around one person, ultimately. But, of course, the news that literally set the internet on fire is that the NX isn't coming this year. And that neither is Zelda. And that at E3, all they will have to show is Zelda.
Yeah, so all this stuff definitely made my Twitter feed meltdown because you've got all the staffers that are paying out of pocket to go to E3, you know, paying like for expensive flights and to go stay in a miserable hotel room shared by three other people. And so the only game there that Nintendo has playable on the floor is Zelda. A game that's not even coming out this year.
For like three more months after the end of the year. March, probably.
At least.
Yeah, like, it's dark. That's a dark situation. And of course, you get Nintendo's benefit. We want to make this an immersive experience. You have a giant... So, like, they've rented a friggin' ton of booth space.
Yeah.
And, granted, E3 is in a weird, like, kind of a wind down right now. A lot of publishers have just said they're not going to be there this year. And booth space is at the opposite of a premium. And Nintendo grabbed up a bunch of it. And it's going to be Zelda.
I guess it's going to be like 1,000 kiosks of Zelda.
And there will be no line to play Zelda.
And think about this. It's a version of Zelda that most people probably won't buy.
Yeah, it's lunacy.
I mean, it's crazy. This, you know, I don't think there's any doubt that the whatever the hell NX is, it's, you know, certainly Nintendo hopes it's more successful, and I'll be surprised if the NX version of Zelda doesn't outsell the Wii U version.
Yeah, which is the other thing they announced, that there will be an NX version of Zelda.
Yeah.
Like all of this is crazy. So, yeah. I mean, think about what's coming out. So, we know Sharp FE is coming out, but that comes out pretty much right after E3. So, that's not really a great candidate. There's a handful of 3DS games that are coming out after E3, but, I mean, if you've been to E3 the last few years, even, you know, I didn't go last year, but I went the year before, like, they really were winding down the 3DS floor presence mm-hmm. at E3.
Look, 3DS has got Pokemon this year, it's fine. It's gonna be fine.
Totally.
And I mean, not only that, but it's got stuff like, you know, Dragon Quest 7 and 8. It's got other things on the horizon.
I mean,
for people
they've
who
sold
have 3DS and want to play.
They've
3DS
sold 1.8 million copies of Fire Emblem Fates, and it hasn't come out in Europe yet.
Yeah,
like they're
plus they're
fine.
They're coming up with additional mobile titles, right? And,
right.
Miitomo seems to be making money without even really trying, at least initially. You know.
So I read somewhere that Miitomo makes about as much in a week as like Monster Strike makes in 4 hours, but still, it's making money. Like at some point, that's not enough, but that's a start. They announced Fire Emblem as one of their mobile properties, which of course proves, if beyond any shadow of a doubt, that Fire Emblem has gone from being like an also ran Nintendo franchise to being a core franchise in the course of like 3 years.
It's gonna be a face rubbing game.
I hope so.
No tactics.
You know, I in the show notes last week, I described the state of the 3DS as anime is happening, and I am excited to see anime happening on my phone now.
It certainly is, yeah.
If it's literally just a like, they just take the engine from Nintendogs and just wrap Fire Emblem characters around it, I'm on board. How much do I have to pay?
I think, you know, I'm not that interested in either, playing either one on my mobile phone. I think Miitomo so far has been a funny little trinket of dumb. And and Guillaume's right. It's made money without even really trying, because that game, I don't think the purpose of it is to make money. I think they had other reasons for making that
it's
and
to
for
get
putting
you to
it
register.
Out. But I mean, Animal Crossing is obviously it's the smartest choice they could possibly make for the phone market. In fact, it probably I doubt it'll be like a really fully fledged thing, but I could see them eventually going that far with it. And I think in a lot of ways, the phone may be the best possible platform for Animal Crossing. So, you know, I would imagine they'll start smaller than that, but if it's a big hit, and it probably will be, I could definitely see them moving in that direction. I don't even want to play the Fire Emblem that I've already paid for this year. Frankly, I'm not that crazy about Fates, and I guess I'm deciding that I don't love Fire Emblem that much because I feel like I've just had enough of it. But I think if you look at the games that are really big hits on the phone market, Fire Emblem fits right in there, and it makes sense. And Nintendo's got the best art and the best music and, you know, some of the best gameplay. They will be able to compete with the huge mega hit strategy games that are on the phone platform. So I think it's a good choice.
The challenge with those games in particular is, like, you can't... I think the takeaway I had from playing Fire Emblem Fates Birthright is that if you dumb one of those games down so much, it loses a lot, and I'm worried that you can't really push the envelope in a mobile game. And of course, I said that it's going to be different. It's not going to be a traditional Fire Emblem game, and I think that's a smart decision because that's a much more of an involved experience. It's not something you play for a few minutes and then close your 3DS and walk away, because you have to build a coherent strategy, and that's not something you can do in tiny pieces. So I'll be curious to see how they sort of adapt the ethos of these two franchises. I think for Animal Crossing, to your point, it's a lot easier.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, you can look at the fact that the stupid Animal Crossing Buy Our Paper Cards edition sold a boatload of copies. That game was grossly successful for what it is. And, you know, I can see the mobile space being equally successful in other kind of unpleasant to think about ways if you're a video game fan. But it's Happy Home Designer, that was it. But it's you know, there's certainly a place there for these two franchises. I was a bit put off by some of the commentary that came out of the investment sphere. You know, I do read a lot of this stuff, and not just Nintendo. I just read, you know, industry stuff.
Are you talking about analysts?
Yeah.
I mean, analysts want them to put all their franchises on the phone.
Well, totally, yeah. But, like, there's this weird kind of not getting it that I don't understand. And the one of the articles I read basically decried the whole situation, saying by not putting Mario on mobile, they were giving up, which is weird because it shows a complete lack of understanding of the success of the Animal Crossing brand, and also that platformers kind of fucking suck on phones.
Yeah.
And I'll take every word I just said out of that sense except kind of. That word can go. Platformers are just miserable garbage on phones.
I mean, unless you make Mario run forward automatically, which honestly takes away one of the principal things
right.
that makes
That's
Mario,
not what Mario
fun
is.
And interesting in the first
well,
place.
Well, what I could really see working is kind of an iteration on the minigames that they had with Super Mario 64 DS.
Sure.
That kind of, you know, like that kind of touchscreen stuff that they were experimenting with. That's what a lot of iPhone games have been for a long time. I think, you know, like they've evolved a bit past that for some of them, but yeah, I'm sure they can build on that at least, you know,
right,
make Mario jump by drawing trampolines, you know, beneath him or whatever.
Yeah, but it doesn't speak to it being a Mario game. That's just a game that features Mario, which
right.
I know.
Yeah,
I know.
But I kind of think that's what the
lot.
Analysts were thinking of, to be honest.
Yeah, I know. But
I don't know. I mean, I think if they make Mario touch and go for your iPhone, I think people will check it out because it's Mario and they'll play it and they might say, oh, this is fun. But none of them are going to be like, this captures the magic of when I was a kid playing Mario. I don't think anybody's going to feel that way about it. You know, it's kind of like Zelda. You can't just throw something on there that looks like Zelda. And that may attract people to try it, but once they play it and they find that it doesn't really make them feel like they're playing a Zelda game. Even people who haven't kept up with these franchises, they have a really deep-seated intuitive feel for what these games should feel like and how they should make you feel when you're playing them. And if they radically change that when they put it on a phone, it's not going to work. People
the brand
won't
has
stick
no meaning
with
at
it.
That point.
Yeah.
You lose the intrinsic value of the brand. And ultimately, the biggest, most comical part of that was the lack of understanding of the value of the Animal Crossing brand. This happened when they announced Miitomo. Like, what the hell are Miis? Like, dude, Miis were a big deal for Nintendo. Like, that was a brand. Like, that was a thing for them. But here's the thing about it. There are 28.9 million, with an M, Amiibo cards. And Amiibo cards are exclusively Animal Crossing. Because despite what I said previously when I was talking about Fire Emblem Cypher, that's a card game that isn't Amiibo enabled. Like, those are just cards. Like, they sold basically 30 million cards of Animal Crossing in a year.
Scary.
Like, this is a brand that can go places. And more specifically, goes places with the kind of people who would play games on a phone.
Yeah, it's perfect.
Like, it's a perfect... Like, the Fire Emblem one I'm more dubious about. Because that one seems to target more hardcore video game players who are more likely to have a video game system. But maybe they feel like the effect of Fire Emblem Awakening and Fire Emblem Fates to sort of level the playing field a bit and invite more people from the outside opens it up a little bit.
Well, also, but it gives them a chance to go after a totally different audience with Fire Emblem.
It does.
Because they've already had all this recent success expanding, you know, the people who like Fire Emblem, who are willing to try it. They've learned a lot about how to make those games more accessible. And they can't make another 3DS. I mean, they probably can't make another, you know, full Fire Emblem game for retail for years at this point. They just released three in a row almost simultaneously. People are going to have their fill of Fire Emblem for a long time on those systems. So,
right. And Black Dragon came out not that long before Fates. I mean, like, it was nuts.
What's Black Dragon?
Black Dragon's the DS one that was a remake of, like, the second NES game. That one came out right as the 3DS was coming out.
Oh, okay.
Like, there was a ton of Fire Emblem in the last few years. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so I think on the phone, it's just a chance for them to pitch that franchise. And they don't have to make it play exactly the same, but I would think it will probably stick fairly close to the tactics roots of Fire Emblem, because those games are already proven to be successful and they work fine on a phone. So I think Nintendo has little reason to dumb it down or to deliver something drastically different on the phone.
I think my biggest takeaway is I'll be curious to see what they do with Fire Emblem and Animal Crossing. To your point, I don't think they'd want to make full games. I don't think there's any way you could successfully monetize a full Fire Emblem game without it just being gross and disgusting. Because you can't sell a $30 game on phones. You just can't do it. To Mr. Iwata's point from almost 6 years ago now, it's the acceptable price for a phone game is so terribly low that you can't do that.
It's the obvious way to do it would be if you get critted, if you're on like classic mode and you get critted on the boss of the stage and your favorite character dies, you could pay 99 cents to...
But that's super disgusting.
Why?
Like, that's...
That's a convenience fee. You can decide, you don't have to pay it, you can decide to play the mission over again, which is what most people who like Fire Emblem would do anyway. Or you could pay 99 cents and have that character, if not come back immediately, then come back the next battle. And then you've turned it into an ad hoc casual mode. In your moment of weakness, we will extract $1 for you because you don't have the patience to play through this again. And everybody who doesn't like it will just say, you should never do that, the way they already say that about the 3DS games. You should never do that. You should replay it again and do it correctly.
I think they've kind of finally suppressed that. When they released the, you know, the one that's harder and the one that's easier, that they kind of pushed that aside. I just think that's the kind of exploitive shit that I hope they don't embrace. I would rather they do something that distinguishes how that game plays from its you know, 3DS counterparts.
Well, they could certainly do a good online mode. I don't know that they want to, but...
Yeah, online with Fire Emblem would be interesting because you'd be waiting a lot. And that would be challenging. It could be kind of like mail chess, which is such a weird anachronism to talk about right now.
Well, it's not, because you get to move all your characters on your turn. So, yeah, you'd have to wait a while to take your next turn, but I feel like, you know, it can take easily 2 or 3 minutes to move all your characters and figure out where you want to put them and go through all those interactions, and then, and it doesn't need the other player to be online to do all those dice rolls.
It can be totally asynchronous, yeah.
Yeah, so you could do a whole turn, it takes 2 or 3 minutes, and then you wait, you know, and then you put your phone back in your pocket, you zip up your pants, and you come back a few hours later, and you do your next turn. It's not a big deal.
So do you have to drop your pants while you're playing it, or is that optional?
I mean, you know how I feel about Fire Emblem.
So you really do want the touching your waifus game. Okay.
Yeah, I want to rub they faces. Yes.
Well, you can use your finger for that, sir. But on a more depressing note, NX is 2017. March 2017 specifically. They did offer a reason for this, which is simply put, they wanted to have the games for a launch. Which,
that's a good reason.
If you go all the way back to the 3DS Wii U intermediary period between the 3DS launch and the Wii U launch, they talked about having learned the lesson of 3DS, which is a system that launched with a bad port of Street Fighter, Pilot Wings, a decent Tom Clancy Fire Emblem knockoff, and am I blanking on something? They had a Tekken. It was Dead or Alive game.
I think there was a Musou.
And there was a Musou game. Yeah, but it was not the most inspiring launch lineup in the world.
Oh,
and
it was
the 3DS
a Ridge Racer.
It was a Ridge Racer. Yeah, it was a decent Ridge Racer, but ultimately the 3DS paid for it. There was the port of the port of the port of the port of Rayman 2.
There was the kind of like half a game of Resident Evil. Maybe that was soon after launch.
That was soon after. It was just the Mercenaries. It was Resident Evil the Mercenaries, yes.
You know, I gotta say, I don't know that having a launch lineup is exactly the right way to characterize the situation here, because to me, both the 3DS and the Wii U had respectable launches. I mean, on the relative scale of launch lineups, which are usually padded with bad and mediocre games, and you're lucky if there's one or two that are worth playing.
Because you can get away with it.
You can get away with it. And really what you want at launch is a little bit of variety, you know? And I think they've done pretty well with that going back several launches, really. I mean, N64 was abysmal, but ever since then, I think even with GameCube and GBA, not a ton of variety, but a little bit. I mean, I think they generally do okay with that. Nintendo's big problem with both 3DS and Wii U, and even with Wii, there was some of this, is that they don't really have things lined up so that games keep coming out throughout the first year. And you really need that, and especially the first big holiday season after launch. And I don't mean immediately after launch. I mean a year later or more.
Christmas number two.
That's really where you have a chance to make the biggest impression. That's where people have heard about it. People have maybe tried it at a friend's house. They want their own system. What are the games that are really going to turn their decision? That's the moment it needs to happen. And that's where Nintendo's done quite poorly the last few launches. So I would hope that this isn't based on what games can we get done by March 2017, because that's probably not going to be a lot different than the games they could get done by November or December of this year. This needs to be about what is the cadence of releases? How are all the potential releases, including from third parties, how are they kind of lining up? And then what's the best place to put that starting point, so that then things are fairly steady after that point, with games that look interesting and that seem to be high quality from a customer, you know, consumer standpoint. I hope that's the basis that they're doing this stuff.
Yeah,
you would hope also that they have a strong enough kind of initial salvo of games to draw enough people to actually not make Ubisoft turn around and say, you know what? This Rayman game that we have here, we're going to sit down and, you know, we're going to sit on it and perhaps port it to other platforms and and sit on it for another extra year.
You know, Yubi's going to Yubi.
However long it was. Yeah.
They're
going to
do their weird
like,
things, what it, you know.
Sure, but that decision wasn't that weird. It was just, you know, they had to, right? Because the Wii U just wasn't selling that much.
Yeah.
And so they thought, well, surely we can have at least triple the sales if we also release on 360.
And they didn't.
Triple the sales? Well, that might have been optimistic. Yeah, I mean, I don't know that they had to. In fact, I think if you look back at Rayman Legends, it might have been a bad decision to do what they did.
Yeah, no, no.
But
I
it
agree,
also might
actually.
Have been a smokescreen for the game wasn't actually finished yet.
That seems to be the more, because they didn't do that with what's the other game? Zombie U. They just put that game out.
Yep. You can get that game on other systems now, by the way.
Yep, that's my point. I think that game just wasn't ready, and that was their convenient excuse was like, oh, it's just not ready.
Mm-hmm.
Even though there were developers that seemed bummed out by the decision, but maybe the game wasn't ready by Ubisoft standards, but devs were like, no, we're done. We can release this.
Yeah,
this
is good. I can understand.
Well,
some
given
people...
that there was like too much of it, I kind of wish they had released the unfinished version.
They did. It was that demo thing they put out, challenge mode.
No, if what you're referring to is that they, you know, kind of converted all those levels from Rayman Origins and stuck those in there. I don't know if that's what they were doing with
that
their time.
That was gross.
But I could have done without that stuff, frankly. Yeah, I mean, yeah. I agree with you. I think Legends would have benefited from being a leaner experience and more focused on the best material that it could bring to the table.
Yeah.
But, in the end, I think it'll also be remembered as one of the best Wii U games. I think it's probably in the top 10 for me.
Not for me.
Rayman Legends is overall pretty damn good.
Yeah, but just my point in general, like whatever the real reason was, the fact is there was one third party publisher that was on Nintendo's side and all of a sudden, you know, seemed to get cold feet.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I feel like with NX, Nintendo may have some insight into what Sony and Microsoft are doing. So that's a wild card here. They talk to suppliers. They have their spies.
Yeah,
they hear from.
I mentioned this in the show a couple weeks ago. Everybody knows what everybody else is doing in this industry.
More or less, because they all have the same partners. More or less.
I mean,
right.
The developers they talk to. I mean, you go out drinking with somebody, you'll get something.
Yeah.
Ultimately.
Yeah. Look, if Emily Rogers can learn all this stuff about NX, then Nintendo can learn stuff about PlayStation. They have more resources than she does.
Sony can learn. I mean, because if Tecmo Koei has got NX kits, which they said in their investor briefing they do, it's not like Sony can't get somebody over there to say, "Hey, what the hell's that NX thing?"
Yeah,
well, yeah, it's not that hard.
Yeah,
I mean, every company I've worked for has done that kind of recon on their major competitors. It's just part of what you do as a big business.
Yeah, they do. So Nintendo may be looking at the heavily rumored upgrade consoles from Sony and Microsoft and said, maybe we don't want to get mixed up in that. We don't necessarily want to draw all the direct comparisons of being released at the same time, in the same holiday season, because they're going to have certainly more robust libraries than we do. And if people compare the prices or the power of our chips and whatever, and the games end up looking kind of similar, but those are cheaper or... Whatever. It's a very complicated marketplace that we're coming up on here, and they have more information about it than we do. So I don't question them delaying the system to 2017.
17. You're right. No, 2017. God.
Yeah.
Damn it.
In fact, yes. I mean, I honestly wouldn't be surprised if it ends up getting pushed back all the way to the end of 2017. My concern is that I think the farther out NX gets, the more really dire the Wii U situation gets. I mean, for all of the misery that the Wii U has had in the marketplace, it has had a fairly steady stream of really good games from Nintendo, if no one else. And I don't think we can really count on that anymore, because clearly they've got to be shifting resources ahead in a very real way. And the farther NX gets rolled back, the less hope that we have that we're still sitting here with Wii U's trying to play video games and waiting for the NX, and that is now almost a year away at least. And what's coming out in the meantime? Paper Mario and Tokyo Mirage Session, which frankly doesn't interest me that much. I'm not sure that Paper Mario interests me that much. I need to see more of it. But right. you know, and the if they had said, you know what, NX isn't coming out until 2017, but Zelda's still coming out this Christmas, I'd be like, okay, sure,
we'll live.
Zelda's going to eat up plenty of my time. That will tide me over until the new system. But now that Zelda's been delayed too, what the fuck are we playing this fall? I mean, I'm playing PlayStation most likely.
Mirage Sessions, which comes out in August. Play that in this fall. It's like, yeah, it's, you know, last year we did the summer of no games. I might have to do the 2016 of no games, which is going to be rough.
I'm sure there's one or two
things. Well, we've got a nice kind of stream of indie titles, upcoming
indie
titles.
3DS is still shockingly vibrant, all things considered.
What's coming? Mm. I mean, I think Axiom Verge
is
out.
You've already played, yes.
In a year, in a month or two. But I mean, I'm just saying, you know, what
you've
what
also
kind
got
of...
Super Meat Boy.
Sure. Man, yeah. But Super Meat Boy is an old game.
I know.
I love it to death. But yeah, and Axiom Verge, obviously, I can highly recommend. And I think it's going to be pretty sweet on the gamepad. I think that's actually a really nice... that's going to be a great way to play that game. But, you know, that's also...
Yeah,
just
it's
by the,
old.
By that doesn't really help them in the marketplace. And, you know, I know their stock price has already been falling. And if I was an investor in Nintendo, which thankfully I'm not, but if not financially, but if I were a Japanese investor in Nintendo, I'd be incredibly concerned right now because their sales for this next 12 months are going to be, you know, on Wii U, nothing. Like less than nothing, which they were already pretty much at.
Right.
They had a good year last year. Considering Splatoon and Mario Maker, but this
and
year
Amiibo.
And Amiibo, of course, that's yeah. But this year, I just can't imagine that they're really gonna come up with much of anything for Wii U. I mean, even if they throw out a surprise game, if it's something for the fans, you know, F-Zero or whatever, I just don't really see that being a sales hit. And anything that would have actually gotten any kind of like widespread attention, they would have already announced it by now. That would be something on the scale of Zelda, which is, we know for sure, not coming out this year. So I think it's going to be a miserable holiday season for them, which will make it, what, 3 out of 4 for Wii U?
Something like that, yeah.
You know, it's really been a debacle this whole generation. They've just mishandled it so badly. And frankly, Zelda is part of that. I mean, I think Nintendo...
Game.
You know, I know Zelda is probably one of the most difficult kinds of games to make, but at some point I feel like Nintendo's got to look at this and say, you know, taking 6 or 7 years to make each console Zelda game is not, that's not viable. That doesn't work. It's not really good business for us. It's not making the fans happy. And by the time the games come out, people have such ridiculous expectations that they can't ever be pleased by what we do, and they don't really appreciate the innovation that we pour into it, not as much as they should. So, like, who wins in this situation where Nintendo releases a console Zelda game every 7 years? They need to find a better way to handle that. If it's a Majora's Mask kind of deal where they reuse some assets, but they just try to keep it fresh as best they can, that worked fine that time. But I don't know. It's really concerning me. It's turning into like Last Guardian territory almost. And
that game's 10 plus years at this point.
Okay, yeah. That's not that much longer than when did Skyward Sword come out? 2010? 2009? It was like 6 or 7 years ago. So and you know, we don't know for sure that Zelda's
2011. It was 2011. It was the end of 2011.
Okay, so it'll be at least 6 years by the time the next Zelda comes out. That's a long time. And
yeah, but I mean, it is a new. Here's the thing.
It's also jumping generations like The Last Guardian did. So it's not that different.
Well, no, The Last Guardian started on the PS3. And it made it all the way into deep PS4 territory.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and it's never releasing on PS3. Whereas
supposed to be a mid Wii U game that will enter late Wii U, early NX. There is a difference.
Can I tell you something that makes me really? There's plenty that makes me happy that Zelda's coming to both systems. But one of my favorite things about it is that it probably means they're not going to have a bunch of like gimmicky Wii U shit in it. Because
maybe.
Because I mean, there'll probably be some stuff that will be exclusive to the Wii U in terms of the way you control it. You know, maybe the kind of menu access that you have, and some people may prefer that. You know, again, we don't actually know what NX can do, so maybe they won't have to sacrifice anything.
Yeah, maybe Miyamoto will, throw out an edict. I don't know how to say that, but
edict.
Anyway, and we'll ask them not to polish the graphics at all, and to really focus on the whatever gimmicky NX thing they're doing. So would that be better? Because we've heard so much about the waggle in Twilight Princess. I don't know. There's no guarantee that this is going to be a happy outcome.
No, I didn't anticipate there being that much Wii U definitive stuff in the NX for Zelda to begin with. Like, I always just assumed it was going to be kind of a, you know, straight line Zelda game. But ultimately, like, yeah, it being on the NX does.
That's a lot of faith on your part, James, because look at Star Fox Zero.
Well, yeah, but I think Star Fox Zero ultimately was, let's call it, laborious birth process.
More appropriately, look at Skyward Sword. Like, this is their MO. They want to do this. And I can understand why, but I think the time to make Zelda for Wii U like a really hardcore Wii U game that uses the gamepad in every way you can think of was about 2 years ago. So I hope they don't do that at this point. I think that could probably only be detrimental to that game's legacy and people's willingness to play it and give it a shot and hopefully enjoy it. I think they probably should focus on just making it like really solid and, you know, polished and hope. I don't know. I think there's less danger of it being like, you know, as much of a turnoff as like Twilight Princess or on Wii was or Skyward Sword. But I don't know. To me, the fact that it has to be cross-platform actually gives me a little bit of it settles down some of the worst fears about what they could have tried to do. I mean, you know, I'm not saying they'd have you like blowing on the microphone on the gamepad or something, but
play solitaire to make Epona ride.
Yeah, they've done things like that in the past, including with Zelda. So
the controls for Skyward Sword weren't the problem; it was the Zelda parts that were the problem. So, like, go nuts! I don't care. Yeah, like, just no. Don't make me fucking collect tadpoles. Like, that's fine.
You're right. Yeah.
So, like, that never bothered me.
I think there was some just. I think Skyward Sword did have some control stuff that was egregious, like flapping the bird wings to fly around the overworld.
Yeah, that was goofy.
And,
but
and
like,
that's not the only example. But for the most part, you're right. It was fine.
Yeah, so, and I look at the Wii U control, the Wii U's gamepad, and I don't really think like, oh man, this is going to go, they're going to go nuts with this. I thought the worst they could do is like, hey, we're going to make you look at both screens, fucking deal with it. And... Right. And that's, you know, whatever. I've gotten used to having to use two screens. It doesn't bother me at this point. But, I mean, you can look at what they did with the Zelda remakes on the Wii U and kind of, that's kind of where I thought they were headed, is that it wouldn't really be that big of a deal. I actually, and I wish I had said this on the show, once they announced Twilight Princess for this, they announced it and then pretty much released it soon after, I thought to myself, uh-oh, this isn't good.
Yeah.
Because, like, why would they dump two Zelda games in the same year? This is a bad sign.
Yeah.
And you know, remember when they announced Wind Waker HD, they said, hey, we just need more time to work on Zelda NX. So we're going to give you a Zelda game right now.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think they were ready to say that this time, but yeah. And of course, the thought process is they were going to delay Zelda out of this year. They sure as hell weren't going to release it after NX came out. If it wasn't going to be an NX game. It's like, well.
Well, I am looking forward to learning more about it at E3. I mean, we were always going to learn more about it at E3, so that's not really new. But I'm still extremely excited for a new Zelda game. And I think it's worth remembering that we actually know damn near nothing about it and haven't seen that game in almost a year and a half. whatsoever.
Yep. The last time we really saw it was the Game Awards in 2014, right?
Yeah. It could turn out to have been radically redesigned since the last time we saw anything of it.
They released a piece of art during the briefings, and it does appear to be the same kind of art, you know, the Link in a blue shirt shooting an arrow with some glowing thing at the end. But that's it. That's all they released. And they've got a lot of frickin' booth space to show a lot of friggin' Zelda. So they had better plan ahead for E3 this year. Ultimately, I think it's a good transition to the fact that that's all that's gonna be playable in their booth, which is a bummer because even today, you know, they said, hey, there are unannounced 3DS games coming. Like, I know they've
unannounced
scaled
Wii
back.
U games coming, I'm sure.
Yeah, but I mean, I know they didn't mention Wii U. They explicitly mentioned 3DS. Like, yeah. There are 3DS games we know about that are coming that I think would have been good to show off in their booth. So it's a bummer they're not doing it. And this is a continuation of them in panic mode on the Wii U and just saying, we're not going to show 3DS games because 3DS is doing okay. And I think that's a failure. I think it makes them look weaker than they actually are. I think they could show off a lot of these, you know, these Sega/Atlas published games that are coming. They could show off their own stuff they've salvaged from other Japanese publishers that's coming. Like they could
maybe the idea is that they think that their what do they call it, the kind of live stream that they do with their Treehouse Live. So maybe they think that's enough. Maybe they think that
it's
social
not,
media
though.
Will take care of it. I mean,
watching somebody play a 3DS game is like having your eyes gouged out because it doesn't look good on a TV. It just doesn't. It looks like shit. You have to play those games.
I was pretty angry about the E3 announcement the morning it came out. This was the one part that I actually felt
is really
a bad move, I think. But I also think it's the least impactful. I mean, it's like...
Totally.
Yeah, most people, yeah.
I have a relationship with E3 that most people don't have, and I kind of take what happens there personally in a way that people do but should not. And this year, I was not planning to go anyway, and I'm not going. And so the more I thought about it, the more I kind of felt at peace with it because doesn't really make any difference to me, and that's the case for 99.99% of people who hear about this. So there's really not that much point in getting angry about it. I mean, they probably will still do a Treehouse Live, and people will still get to watch that, and I'm sure they'll play more than just Zelda on that thing. So it really only matters to the people who are attending E3, which is increasingly not as many people or not as important of people.
It was definitely less crowded when I went 2 years ago than it was the 2 years prior.
And I think they're starting to pad it with people who either, you know, won contests or they just work at GameStop and, you know, wherever. I mean, it just feels like a lot of the business that gets done there, a lot of the marketing and stuff, like that tends to happen at actual retail, you know, like retailer-specific events, like the annual GameStop conference and stuff like that. The annual Best Buy conference. Like, that's where a lot of the business that used to happen at E3, I think that's where a lot of that happens.
What worries me more, though, is that this is a chance for those games to get out and get impressions recorded on them. And, like, people get to talk about games that ultimately all... Like I said, watching a 3DS game in video kind of sucks. Because it's a low resolution, and you're not necessarily
watching the 3DS game. You're watching PewDiePie play the 3DS game.
That sucks even more, Guillaume. That
well,
sucks
I
ten
agree,
times as
but,
much.
That's what works.
We'll also say, and I think, James, certainly you could agree with me that hands-on impressions are our favorite kind of content to write for the website.
Totally.
But they are not among the most popular kinds of articles to read.
In terms of our readership, they're not great.
Even at E3, when we have access to these games that nobody's ever played before, and we are among the first people to ever write about them, and we can tell you all kinds of really cool details that no one else knows because we played it ourselves, even then, people don't actually click on those articles that much. So I'm sure Nintendo's looking at this thinking, you know, we'll miss out on some of the usual coverage, but it doesn't amount to much, and it's not that big of a sacrifice.
I'm saying this as somebody who, I actually registered for E3 the day before, and then immediately said, you know what, I ain't going. Not being there and not playing these games, like, it's a bummer to basically know that nobody's going to have impressions of how some of these games play. Like,
yeah.
I really want to know what these games feel like. And I mean, granted, they brought a bunch of games to PAX last weekend, and people got to play them. And that makes a difference. Like, mm-hmm. people actually got to see these games and play them, and members of the public saw them and played them versus members of the media.
Very small percentage of the people who attend E3.
That's what I'm saying. As opposed mm-hmm. to us. I mean, to your point, we had the very first impressions on the internet of Skyward Sword.
Mm-hmm.
And we had them because I played them at the end of the event and then fucking ran and wrote them as fast as possible. And we didn't get that much hits for them.
No, but it is probably one of your favorite memories of working for the website, which we'll talk about when I interview you for the book.
It was one of the worst memories of just that dead sprint I had to do. Yeah. But like, yeah,
I think our gripes about this E3 stuff this year are selfish, maybe too strong of a word, but I think we just have a really particular viewpoint on it that other people can't and maybe shouldn't sympathize
with. I want to be able to read impressions of other games. Like, just to know, like, okay, that's how that game plays. It feels good. It feels, like, if let's say to use a recent example, when I heard they were releasing a Long Greaser game on 3DS, I was like, oh, really? That franchise is coming back? And then I heard it was made of butt. It would be nice to have seen impressions that it was a hot mess of garbage before I got even remotely emotionally invested in it. And if they were showing off the scope of 3DS games that are coming, like, I could filter that out and I could see games that maybe I wouldn't have paid attention to and gone, oh, that's actually a good game. I should be watching for it.
Mm-hmm.
But ultimately they're foregoing on that, which is a bummer. I think, and it's not just this year. I think they've done a very bad job by the 3DS with respect to E3 for the last, 3 years, 4 years? And I think that's a mistake. And it sucks because it's their more successful platform. And I know why they don't feel like it's as important, but they should have given it more love. And that's 3DS is what's going to sustain this show. I say this as the host of the show, like, 3DS is going to make this show go for the next 7 or 8 months.
Yeah.
We're going to be riding a maelstrom.
Well, there's also, you know, 3DS at least has turned into a pretty interesting virtual console domain with the Super Nintendo stuff and now also potentially DS games coming, like with WarioWare Touched. If that ends up being kind of a harbinger, then I think there could be, you know, some interesting stuff to kind of keep the show going. Wasteland.
Yeah, it's just we need having stuff to talk about ultimately. Like, this is selfish. I want to know what 3DS games I should invest my money in, because ultimately, for the purposes of the show, it's good for us if we just get them right off the bat versus waiting 2 or 3 weeks when you guys aren't necessarily interested in hearing about the game because you've already started playing it.
Yeah, we've heard a lot of other people talk about
right.
it.
Right. I mean, we have a public service to a certain extent here to talk about games that are new. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we're not obligated to acquire these games, but it's good for us and it's good for you if we get them relatively early and can be interesting about them. And ultimately, you know, I take that responsibility with some degree of seriousness. Ultimately, that's why I bought Yo-Kai Watch, 6 or 7 months ago. And yeah, I did enjoy it because it's stupid as crap. But I didn't know if I was going to enjoy it because they didn't show it at E3, which is insane to think about. Like, that is a huge why?
Yeah.
Why was it not on display? But it wasn't.
Yeah.
Anyway, we spent a lot of time talking about E3, and ultimately we talked about the others. I don't want to talk about financials too much. You know, my financial billabuddy's not here.
No, and I don't want to get into that. But I do have one final thought on the E3 situation, which is that I think it's really a shame that they're not taking this opportunity. You know, if they have little or no lineup of their own that they really want to showcase, or if they don't want to deal with the hassle of bringing all those demos and training people, I think they could at least set up one of their three booths, or even just kind of a little row of indie developers and bring them to E3 and let them demo their own games to the, you know, and show, oh, hey, there is stuff. Because at this point, especially for Wii U, the indie output is a pretty substantial part of the library.
Totally.
You know, any given week, it's probably just indie games coming out for the Wii U. So I think it would serve them well to highlight that, and it would also be a really nice olive branch You know, they're paying for all this stuff anyway at the show. I don't think having, you know, indie games in the back corner would detract very much from the immersive Zelda experience that they're offering and focusing on. But I think that's kind of a shame. I mean, I think it's too bad for Paper Mario. It's too bad for Dragon Quest VII. Totally. It's too bad for all the other stuff that they're releasing this year. But I think it's especially bad for indies because it's a unique opportunity to put that stuff out there. And when you, again, I've said this before, but when you look across the aisle at Sony's booth, which is at least 50% indie games, which are extremely well attended and which end up performing mostly very well when they come out on that platform, I think it's really a missed opportunity.
Yep, I agree. And especially this year when you've got space, Nintendo.
Yeah, when you got fuck all else to show. I mean, you might as well.
Well, you need the space for the crane game where you can win a new 3DS or whatever. Well, I mean, can't remember what was actually happening last year. But
when they have a real-life wolf walking around that they've dyed its hair gray because you're having your immersive Zelda experience, just don't let it bite you, and be good in line, and it'll be fine.
Charles Martinet ad-libbing from a booth with a virtual Mario head.
He does that when he's not even invited to either. He just shows up and starts.
With or without the booth. That time he had the booth, and that takes up space.
That's true. I mean, he takes up space when he's not even invited because he attracts a crowd, and Nintendo's handler's like, well, we can't ask him to leave, but he's just here doing Mario. We don't even have a Mario game this year. What's he doing? Like, I've overheard conversations about Mr. Martinet where they're just like, he's in the booth just Marioing. And like, they're like, oh, it's fine. Just let him do it.
Yeah.
And you're like, it's like, they're like, they don't even know why he's here. He just got in. It's fantastic.
Dude, actually, it's pretty common to see that. And not just with Charles, but a lot of people will just kind of show up in Nintendo's booth and attract attention because there's always a shitload of people at Nintendo's booth. It's always pretty much the busiest booth at the whole show. And I think that'll probably still be the case this year. I think there's enough curiosity about Zelda. And, you know, thinking about their immersive experience, it could be like, hey, you go in, you pick up a little plastic sword and shield, you walk through a simulated field and then a forest and then a cave, and then you go into the dungeon to finally play the demo, and then you have to, like, explore your way back out of it, and you find a treasure chest. What's in it? Oh, my gosh.
Charles Martinet's in it. Oh, my God.
But, yeah, I could see them doing stuff like that, and although it might be fun if you get to do it, I also think that's not a good reason to devote the entire booth to just one game. It just so you can pull off this weird, you know, kind of gimmicky thing. And that you see that stuff all the time at E3 from a lot of companies.
Yeah. We'll see. They did it for Twilight Princess Round 2, right? The second time it was at E3?
No.
Was it the second or they did do a pretty heavily themed for Twilight Princess at one point. I just can't remember which showing it was.
I mean, in terms of just decoration.
No, like, they had, like, there were, like, weird chambers and stuff in their booth. I'm trying to remember what year it was, though. Like, I've seen pictures. It's pretty bizarre.
I don't remember that, but there was a year for GameCube where they had all these kind of private rooms where they weren't private. You could just walk into them, but a lot of people didn't know that, and so they didn't, and so they tended to be not too crowded for the most part. Mm. But they had kind of, like, blackout curtains that provided some soundproofing, and you'd go in, and they had, you know, you could really hear the game, and there was someone in there, and, you know, like, Dennis Dyack would be in there demoing Eternal Darkness, and you could just go in and hang out and, like, just chat with these people. They could walk you through a whole demo, and it was really kind of like this solace from the rest of the show.
Did he try to sell you on his new pitch? Was he like, hey, I'm looking for investors on this game I've got, idea I've got? Like, Dennis, I just want to play Eternal Darkness.
No, his investors were Nintendo back then, if you'll recall.
That's true. Yeah. That's before the dark times.
Yeah, no, he was hot shit, man. Back then.
Man.
And he had one of the best games at the show, and that was a year where there were a lot of good games at the show.
There has got to be more in their booth than Zelda. I just can't. I can't. Like,
what if you have to find the secret demos of the other games?
They've got
within
so much space. Like, how? We're going to have every person at E3 will have their own kiosk to play Zelda. Like, that's how we're going to do it. It's like, well, what on earth? What's,
you know,
the
at the same time, I do also wonder if this might be an opportunity for them to put the other demos that they might have usually had there. Maybe they just put those on the eShop and they let people try them.
Maybe. I hope beyond hope that there is at least an indie game component or a 3DS area that they're just not talking about right now. That maybe the translation was, this is the only NX game we're publishing, we're showing, or something like that.
Yeah.
And it's, but, you know, it's what it is. Anyway, there are Wii U games to talk about. And we're, well, most of us are going to talk about them. Because we're going to do new business after the break. See you soon. And we're back. And I realized at the start of the show, I never actually gave the date or the episode number. I gave the date for an old episode.
Yeah, that got me real confused.
But in case you're, I was trying to give like a dramatic open, like 3.5 years ago, we had a really depressing episode. This one could be this, but that's not, you know, I didn't stick the landing. But in case you're wondering, I'm giving you context an hour in. It's the end of April 2016, and it's episode 474, probably. So I'm doing it to start a new business. So I guess technically speaking, I didn't make a mistake yet because this is new business in the second half of the show. So here it is. Johnny, as the guest, you've got a game to talk about that we've spent some time on, but we haven't heard your thoughts on it.
Yeah, I imagine you don't have much more to add about this, but for those nostalgic for the months of Xenoblade Chronicles X discussion that have occurred since I left the show, I can add a little bit to it. And I want to start by saying that I have not yet listened to your spoiler cast on it. It's been... I downloaded it, and I'm saving it, and I think I will be able to listen to it soon. Not because I think that I will beat the game soon, but I think I will quit the game soon. And quit in glory. I will have decided that I am satisfied with what I've played of the game, which is like, I don't know, 50 or 60 hours at least. It's been a good run, and right now my goal is to get the flying skill. And I'm really close because I'm about to finish the what are they called, the
affinity.
Affinity, thank you. Yeah. Yes, the affinity mission that allows me to start chapter 9. And apparently, once you finish chapter 9, or while you're in chapter 9, I don't know. Apparently, that's when the mission to get flying scales opens up. So I'm really close. Once I do that, I will fly around for a couple hours and then probably decide I've had enough, because that's right now, that's the carrot. And I don't care about beating the game, really, unless you guys tell me that I should really care about beating the game and that it's worth another 40 hours of my life, which is quite an ask at this point. So
I was going to make a joke. You should stick with it for like 20 to 30 more hours.
Yeah.
But,
no,
I'm not sure. Like, would it take 40 hours to take from the flying scale to the end? Yeah.
It depends. If you want to just straight shot to the end,
I do.
It's probably not that far out.
In fact, I've been trying to straight shot this entire game, and that's
because the game ends on what, chapter 10?
I think there's 12 or 13.
No, there's, yeah.
Yeah, I know the last two chapters are essentially, once you start one, you're basically catapulted through the last two. I just can't remember if that's chapter 10 or chapter 11 is the one that once you start it, you're basically just shot through it. But even then, you're probably going to want to upgrade your skills, because the skills are super useful in the final fight, and that, of course, requires you do some work.
Yeah, that's the problem here, is that I don't like grinding in Xenoblade because I don't know how to grind in Xenoblade. The systems and the communication that I get from the game in terms of what's effective and what's a good area for me to be at, especially once they introduce the skills, I can't even really look at an enemy's level and figure out whether or not I have a chance to beat it, because they've screwed up that math a whole bunch. I don't know whether all this character development I'm doing in terms of ground gear and skills and arts, like, how much of that is even relevant to the rest of the game, because it doesn't seem to matter when I'm in my skill. How do I upgrade my skill? That's a whole other system that they've now stacked on top of this already very complicated thing. And I don't really feel like I'm not getting much access. Like, the stuff is either really expensive or it's a very high level. Like, the scale frames and the equipment for those frames jumps from level 30 to 50. They're,
right.
So you get, once you hit level 30, which for me was like 10 hours ago, you get access to all this new stuff, and it's like, oh, cool. But then you don't get access to new stuff on top of that until you hit 50. That's a long time afterward. So to me, I feel like it's actually like taking longer to grind to the next tier of being able to go do the next mission. It's like, actually, the amount of time and effort it takes to do that is just getting longer and longer as the game goes on. So I and also the sense of discovery and exploration, I'm losing it because, you know, when I first got the skills, I had a good time for a few hours running around, checking out places I couldn't get to before, and also feeling super powerful and no longer scared to go out and try this new continent or whatever. But I'm over that. I've gone to most of the places that the skill will let me get to. There's still a bunch of the world I haven't seen yet, but I can't really get to it. It's either too hard or I can't actually access it yet. And so I'm just sort of at this point where I really just want to break through this next barrier and kind of get that last big open chunk of game. And that's really the only thing I'm looking forward to anymore. And it's not that I'm not having fun with it. I just feel like I've played enough of this damn game. I've put plenty of time into it. It has kept me from playing a lot of other things. I mean, I've been through a period in my life where my free time to play games has been fairly restricted. And so I have to think carefully about what I play. And I had already started Xenoblade. I'd been looking forward to it for years and years. And I liked the beginning of it. And so I've kept pouring more time into it. But as I keep playing, I just feel like I'm sort of getting less and less out of it. And it's not that I don't really dislike anything about the game in particular. I just feel like it's not a very efficient way for me to have fun. I feel like there are other games that I could have more fun in the limited time that I have to play it. It's just the padding that it has, and it has tons of padding. Mm-hmm. The padding that it has, I can no longer really afford or enjoy. And that makes the game just kind of, you know, laborious at times.
I've missed you. I've missed you so much.
It's rough too, to have two people with bad opinions on this episode. it's difficult to describe much in this game as padding, insofar as so much of the game isn't the core story.
No, I'm not even talking about missions. There's tons of side quests that are a bunch of nothing. Let me put it this way, James. I've gotten to the point where I will only accept gather quests if I already have all the items that they require.
Definitely. That was basically how I worked most of the game.
Yeah, I will only accept an affinity quest if it is required to proceed the story. And I will only accept the story request if it gets me closer to the flying skills, after which point I probably won't take any more of them on because I don't actually care about the story, because there's not even much of a story at all. This game is all premise. The premise is awesome and fascinating, mm-hmm. and so cool. The actual plot of the game is a bunch of nothing. The characters are either annoying or basically not, they have no personality. So I think, you know, the writing is very good, but there's way too much of it, including just like nondescript, practically unnamed characters who give you side quests who ramble on for 10 or 12 frames of text. Really? You could have said all this in one. You know, it's like the menus that I have to go like five layers deep to find the one thing that actually makes a difference when I get into battle. The fact that I have to tap the A button like six times to get into the game. These things all add up to a whole lot of disrespect for my personal time. And look, it's a 100-hour RPG. They obviously don't give a fuck about how much time I have to pour into this game. But, you know, for a game that you are coming back to many times over probably a very lengthy period, I feel like there's a lot of efficiencies here that the creators of Xenoblade should have picked up on when they were studying all those Western games that they're such big fans of. Because I don't think Western games do a lot of this stuff. And I think the game would be better without it, you know.
So I do have a couple things that might help you get through some of this stuff.
Okay.
In terms of figuring out where you can gain experience and stuff, one thing I didn't do almost explicitly was I didn't really grind until the very, very end. And I only did it there because I came across an enemy that my skill could one-shot, and for whatever reason, the game math just freaked the fuck out with this one enemy. It's like, here is a boatload of experience for this thing that isn't of no danger whatsoever.
How do you know that you're getting a boatload of experience? I feel like that's not even transparent enough. I don't even know.
It tells
know.
You how much. I mean, you say so you can watch the little, you can watch the little bars move for your
the
experience.
The little
bars.
Tiny green bars on the next what? To your character profile?
Yeah.
Okay.
I just watched them jack up. Like I was just going through. And I think it's in the upper, you can't get there yet. When you can fly, there's kind of an upper area of the forest, Noctilum.
Mm-hmm.
And there are these, this random enemy that with the hexagon gun just levels, but for whatever reason gives way more experience than it probably is meant to. Like, it's almost a bug.
So you found the metal slimes and exploited them.
Basically, yeah. Yeah. But even then, I wasn't just grinding to grind. Like, I just happened across, like, well, I'm going to kill all of these things.
Yeah. Hey, in a game like this, if you find some kind of exploit or bonus area where you could pour in 30 minutes and save yourself 6 hours down the line, of course you would do that.
Yeah.
You know?
But I'm just saying
that shouldn't be necessary.
No, I think you can totally do this game without grinding, but I do think, to your point, there's this weird sense of understanding how skells work and how to build a good skell and what party skell configurations make sense. That is difficult. You can totally beat the final boss of this game without a skell. I have seen character, but the character build system is super deep, and I don't even understand it having beaten the game.
Mm.
Like, I understand it at a base level, but I've seen videos of people who have made these kind of hyper evolved, hyper developed characters that can, you know, there's that turbo mode of the game that your character can go into, where they can find a way, overdrive, I think, where they can just hold it for basically the entire battle and just maintain overdrive mode and just kill those bonus enemies from the online mode. They can just kill them in two or three hits over and over and over and over and over again. And they would annihilate the final boss of this game. And I just don't understand how to make that build, but there is a certain degree of there's a depth here that even I don't get. But from a skill standpoint, there's a handful of skills, specifically the Mastema, that with one heavy, heavy, heavy hitting gun, and then everything else is based around stun, initiating the ZRLR lock, and quick recharge to try to trigger that kind of in cockpit mode to reset all your weapons.
Mm-hmm.
Like, that's really, for the skell build, what makes the most sense. High defense, one super powered hitting thing, and then everything else is driven towards locking up the enemy or trying to fire them off a lot so you get that quick inside mode to reset all your cooldowns. And that helps a lot. In terms of the hammering A button just to start the game, obviously the answer is just never stop playing. Just play forever. I just had 2 weeks off ultimately, and that's how I marathoned the game. And if you can just drive through, and I mean that by these long sessions, a lot of the stuff works out better.
That is not really an option for me.
No, I understand. It's just a weird thing about this game. Like, when I was playing it in short bursts, it was way more frustrating than when I just said, I've got 4 hours, I'm just going to go.
Yeah.
And I think that goes back to kind of the exploration component. Like, if I sat down to do, I'm going to do one thing, it felt like I very much had to do that one thing. And if I got stopped by anything, it was obnoxious. Versus if I just said, I've got 5 hours. Let's just do stuff.
Yeah, let's pick a direction and just go.
Yeah, I feel like that worked out a lot. It's a very weird thing. I don't know that I've had a game. In fact, we've talked about RPGs on this show where we kind of praise the fact that you can sit down and do this, 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 and very, discrete chunks of work. I don't know if we've ever had one where I walked away feeling like the fact that it doesn't lend itself to that was a positive.
Right.
Where the experience was better when you're not trying to accomplish that.
I've had sessions with Xenoblade where I only had about 30 minutes to play it, and I'd go in and try one mission, and a lot of times I wouldn't even finish that mission. You know, it'd be a hard one, and I would fail a couple times, and I'd have to stop because I'd have to go somewhere.
Totally.
Those are very unsatisfying, but even if you do complete one mission, completing one mission in this game is not very satisfying. You know, no, I think there's something about the way that your accomplishments and your progress is displayed on the screen, the way that it doesn't really call, you know, like this game has to be, it is so whatever about things like level ups and rank ups. Like it, you know, when you get a blade level up, which is something that can only happen, what, 9 or 10 times across 100 hours of gameplay, it's a very special
event.
It's
a big deal.
Okay? When that happens, it takes a long time to do that. There's all kinds of stuff you have to do. But when you get a blade level up, the little notice flashes up on the screen for, what, like half a second, and it looks just like a bunch of other little notifications. Like, you could easily miss it or ignore it. And then
and I did.
The major impact of that that has is that there's this one lady that you have to go talk to, and the game doesn't remind you that she's ready with this bonus for you. You know, there's nothing hanging out over her head that says, hey, you probably want to talk to her, you know, which would be useful if you didn't even realize that you got the level up. So there's just a bunch of stuff about, like, really key things that gate your progress in the game, or that you should be doing in order to really keep moving forward and keep having fun and keep engaging with the game in the way that the designers want you to. And I feel like they're just not communicated very well. But in particular, the thing about hitting A a bunch of times to get started, I picked up on that because I've been playing the game off TV quite a bit, which I love.
Yep.
And it's a great, it's what a wonderful feature for this game to have. By the way, the original, arguably superior, Xenoblade Chronicles now also has that feature if you buy it on Wii U. I think that's a pretty strong selling point for that game. I mean, it was a selling point for the new 3DS version as well, but that game had other problems, and I think that screen is, you know, probably too small. I think the gamepad screen is a good size for playing a game like this, and I've really enjoyed that, and it works very well. It's a little irritating to have to keep tapping the screen to access the map, because you do have to use the map quite a lot in Chronicles X. But it works, and it's really good. But when you start the game from the gamepad, if the TV's off or it's on something else, and you start the game from the gamepad, it just has like what looks like a loading screen shown on the gamepad, and you have to blindly press A about 3 or 4 times and then wait about 20-30 seconds before the icon pops up that lets you switch the display down there. And so that's actually where I started to realize, wow, there's a whole screen where it says you joined a squad.
Do you want to be online is what that screen is.
That's like, the menu. Yes. Yeah, but you have to push A twice in order to make one of the selections there, and then it brings up a screen that says you joined a squad, which for me it's always the Lifehold squad, because I'm really just playing by myself. I don't care about all that other crap. I don't want to have to deal with it. I just want to play the damn game, and so I'm just mashing A. But when it brings up the screen, the unnecessary screen that says you joined a squad, it leaves that up there, and you have to actually wait 2 or 3 seconds before the prompt comes up for you to press A yet again in order to move forward. That whole thing could have just been not there, and the game would play the same way, and it not only would save you a lot of time booting up the game and getting into the experience as fast as possible, but it would actually make the whole off-TV thing work a lot better.
I always assumed it was doing something on the back end, like interfacing with the servers. Like that was my because your point, there's like that weird wait where you can't press A. Like, I always thought it was just trying to grab data or something.
Yeah, well, like, they could have done that while you had already started your single player game.
Thank you.
And the whole thing about, you know, like you have to
even
back out of the
squad, you're still online.
Yeah, I know, but that's kind of fucked up because like,
I don't mind that as long as they don't punish me for their weird decision to make me play my single player game online.
Because isn't the next screen the one where it shows you like the progress on the world mission?
Yeah.
Does that even mean?
Yeah, exactly. That has no bearing on what I'm doing in this game.
I understand. I think that's what it's downloading, though, ultimately. Like, I'm thinking like a programmer right now. It's doing something. It's not just like, middle fingers, wait for the screen to finish. You better know you're in the Lifehold squad. Like, there is activity happening. But ultimately, the squads don't make a lot of difference, so I kind of wonder their purpose anyway. You just get more notices. I will say the one thing though, when I was saying like the game feels different when you go long sessions, is where it does show progress versus your character progression is kind of world changes when you do stuff. When you do some quests and things change in that world that you're in.
That could happen a lot more. You can't really tell which quests are going to turn out that way.
But
and also
I actually kind of liked that, though. Like, I liked being surprised by it. Like, you get on a quest chain that seemed inconsequential, and then suddenly it changes quite a bit, and the end result is this whole other race you didn't know about is now hanging out with the man on.
Yeah. Yeah.
I liked being surprised by that.
Absolutely. I like that stuff a lot.
There's a weird one where you're like, hey, I think somebody's snooping around our garbage. And you're like, oh, this is going to be some dumb shit, isn't it? And then at the end, you've got like this whole race of weirdos just wandering around. And you would never have guessed that. You would have thought this was going to be one where, like, they're going to do one of their comedy things where you'll find somebody and he pantomimes that he's scared you found him and you'll chase him and then you'll kill something. But no, it's not that at all. And it was stupid and funny and I enjoyed it. But there is like this weird... It's when you get on a quest chain and you can just work that chain. That, to me, that was when the game really felt cool because you got to watch these, what would normally be especially even in Xenoblade Chronicles, really unimportant characters. You got to watch them do stuff and become something different than they were.
Mm-hmm.
And to your point, I think that's where the writing actually worked really well.
Yeah, there's a lot of care and detail put into characters who don't really seem like they deserve it.
Right.
So anyway, there's some polish that I think this game could have benefited from. And maybe if it had been a big seller, they could have gone back and made some updates to it like they have with Splatoon and Mario Maker. But, you know, certainly I've enjoyed it, most of it, and it does certain things better than any other game I've ever played. And they're things that I care about. It's the sense of discovery, the scale of the world, the alienness of this place, and the feeling that almost anything could happen when you go out on an adventure, and the fact that it rewards you for doing all the really fun things that aren't just battling monsters over and over again. You know, I really dig all that stuff. I think in a number of ways, I do prefer the first Xenoblade. I certainly think it has a far better story, and much better music, but I think there's things that X does better as well. And I think the scales really are probably, you know, the biggest thing. I think they're really cool. They feel different and fun, and it's really exciting when you get them. And that's why I want to get the flying unit, because I want to get another hit of that feeling. And then I think, like I said, I think I'll have seen enough of this game, but I certainly don't regret my time with it. And that means something, because it's been a lot of time, even though less than you guys. So
just give it 40 or 50 more hours, and you'll be there. It'd be fine.
Yeah. So before everything I move will be on, fine. I have one more thing I want to do. This is not a game I've been playing, but rather a little feature, mini feature that I put together that I thought might be kind of fun. Because, you know, I've been listening to you guys every episode. It's, you know,
this isn't going
to
be corrections, is it?
No, it's not corrections at all. Absolutely not. So I'm calling it Why Not. And these are games that I'm wondering why you guys aren't playing them, and I've chosen one for each of you individually.
Okay. So,
well, I've already got my answer, but go ahead.
Unfortunately, John and Greg aren't here to respond, but I'll throw them out there. They can respond next week if they feel like it, or you guys can comment. These are all serious, by the way. I guess they're recommendations, but they're also me wondering. I'm surprised that you guys aren't playing these games, because it seems like they're up your alley. So it's a little bit of me trying to assess your taste also. So for John, I put Star Fox Zero. I feel like, you know, John is really into old school arcade shooters. He's talked about Space Harrier and Choaniki and all those other classic shooters. I think he's a Star Fox fan too. I know he likes Sin and Punishment. I mean, as mixed as people seem to be on Star Fox Zero, I'm sure John would have some things to complain about, but I also think he would probably enjoy it a lot. So I'm on the fence, leaning towards not not buying it. I would be happy to borrow it from someone or play it for a couple hours, but I'm not. I don't really think that game is. I'm not going to get $50 worth of fun out of that game based on what I've heard. The main thing for me is that it's just too similar to Star Fox 64, which I've already played a bajillion times, including on three different systems, including pretty recently on 3DS. So the Star Fox 64, of all the games in the series, was the one that least needs to be remade or inspire a new sequel, and I'm pretty disappointed that they've kind of leaned that hard on it. But yeah, I think John should play Star Fox Zero. I'm kind of surprised that he hasn't been more inclined to do so. Greg was actually the hardest to choose here, and maybe it's because there's now a big gap in Greg's game history where I don't know as much about what he was playing or what he thought of games. But Greg tends to go out and seek exactly the kinds of games that he likes the best. So it's hard to find one that he hasn't checked out already. There's not much that can get between Greg and a game that's up his alley. He tends to be pretty tenacious about that. But one that I believe he does not currently have a system to play it on, which would be a good reason why not, is called Salt and Sanctuary. If you haven't heard of it, apparently, I haven't tried it myself, I'm quite curious, but it's a very challenging 2D platformer with some aspects of Metroid, but also kind of, it's been compared a lot to like a side-scrolling Dark Souls.
Or Castlevania,
exactly, which is one of the things that made me think of it for Greg. So I believe right now it's only on PS4, which he doesn't have, but it's also coming to Vita and Windows, and maybe other systems after that, but it sounds pretty interesting. So that's kind of the outlier, though, because it's not on a Nintendo system, at least not yet. But for you, James, I chose Pokken Tournament.
Yeah.
Have you been tempted by this at all?
No.
Oh, because I played the demo a couple nights ago, and I thought it felt a lot like Bloody Roar. And I was like,
really?
Yeah.
Oh,
and,
no.
Or, and also Tekken Tag, like that kind of dumb crap. It seems like something you would like.
That's tempting.
Yeah, it's really goofy and flashy and funny.
How's the Snoop Dogg track on it?
That's maybe coming as DLC.
There is a stage based on the fishing boat level of Tekken Tag.
Wow.
Yeah, they roll in magic carps instead.
But specifically, Bloody Roar, though, it actually did remind me a lot of Bloody Roar.
Really?
I couldn't place it at first. I was like, what does this feel like? And it was like, oh, yeah, it was not that long ago on RFN 400 that we played a bunch of Bloody Roar for GameCube.
Aiting still lives.
Yes, and I remember you being like kind of a weird savant at that game.
Well, except like all my skills were gone and I couldn't remember any combos, so I just like crap during the stream. I like went home afterwards and just marathoned until I was sharp with that game again because I was so embarrassed.
You had to regain your honor with Bloody Roar Primal Fury.
So like I could now just run through the entire tournament ladder, including the secret bosses, and just ace that game. And I was like, oh, this is embarrassing.
You had to prove to the world your mastery of that lady who turns into a bunny rabbit.
She is Alice is fantastic, but you know she's not Yugo. You guys got power and speed.
Anyway, James, there's a free demo. You should at least check out Pokken Tournament.
I'll check out the demo.
Talk about it on the show. I think you might be pleasantly surprised. I think it's a game that, and it, you know, it has an online mode. I don't know if it's any good, but it seems like something you could get into. So, and then for Guillaume, again, Guy, I think you're pretty aware of the games that you're into, and you tend to go after them. So I had to think a little bit about this one, and this might not be a perfect fit, but I kind of feel like I'm surprised you haven't talked about Mutant Mud's Super Challenge. And I couldn't quite remember if you were really into the first one, but I think you were, right?
Yeah, I was. Like, the game had... it's kind of funny, because on Twitter at some point... Jules Watcham revealed that Renegade Kid pitched a GBA version of Demon's Crest to Capcom, and that was rejected. But when you think about that and you think about the controls in Mutant Muds with the hovering and stuff, it kind of makes sense, you know?
Right.
So, yeah. But, no, so I enjoy that type of platformer and everything. I just, no time. I've got no time. I was kind of in a weird gaming funk a few weeks ago. Listeners, I think, noticed. But now I'm back. There's so many things.
Pocket Card Jockey saved us all.
Yeah. Well, for what it's worth, I got Super Challenge. It is balls ass hard. It's hard to a degree that I kind of felt the first Mutant Muds was just the right amount of really, really hard. So I would have just been happy if they had kept it the same difficulty and just made new levels. But it's really good, and I think it would be a nice palate cleanser for all your RPGs lately.
Hmm.
So,
all right, John, here's one for you, and I thought this was going to be the one you named for Greg. And I'm curious if you've played this one. But have you played Odalis?
What? I've never heard of Odalis.
It's a Steam game.
Yeah, it's kind of like a Metroidvania, but before that concept existed. Like, it's a little bit more Super Castlevania with Metroid elements.
Hmm.
It's a 2D action platformer with upgrades that are hidden in the stage.
Cool.
Like, I thought that's where we were going, but also you play a burly Irish type who kills gothic looking monsters. It is what it is. It's interesting game, say the least. Hmm. But I thought you're right. Salt and Sanctuary also works here too.
I will check it out. I'm not playing a lot of Steam games right now, but I kind of have a backlog, and it's been on my to-do list for over 6 months that I want to have a week where all I play are Steam games.
Well, then I would definitely wait till it comes up on sale again, but it's interesting.
Okay, well, maybe I'll wishlist it. There is actually a Steam game that is very much up my alley, and probably not just me on this show, but that's Hyper Light Drifter, and I'm just waiting for the PS4 version, because I'm not totally confident that my Surface Pro 3 would run it well, and also I don't really want to play it on my Surface Pro 3. I'd rather sit on my couch and really wrestle with it. But I've heard really good things about it. I saw the Easy Allies video review of it from our friends Dan Bloodworth and Brandon Jones. So
yeah, that sounds good.
Yeah,
yeah.
That it looks really cool. It sounds like totally obtuse and mysterious and beautiful and exciting and
kind Zelda-y. Of Zelda-y.
Hell yeah.
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 Yes. Oh, so, totally.
And hard, like really challenging too. That sounds awesome. But I will check out Odalis as well. That sounds intriguing. So anyway, that was a long new business. I apologize.
Yeah. Guillaume.
Yes. So, I've been playing Star Fox Zero. And, okay. So I got the game. And the first stage, of course, is Corneria, and it's a corridor shooter. And, you know, like a lot of people have talked about the controls, the motion, they're not optional. So Corneria, you don't really have to use the motion controls that much. And also, I had played that level in a Nintendo of Canada event. Mm-hmm. So I could hold my own, and like it's the first level. It's easy.
But, it's Corneria.
Yeah, it's Corneria. But soon enough, the game throws the transformations at you, the chicken walker. And before actually playing with these vehicles and playing the full game, I thought that the idea of piloting a ship and not looking where you're going was the stupidest, and that playing as a bipedal kind of machine that can strafe would make sense. And then to my surprise, the flying segments were just fine, and the bipedal stuff is the stuff that gave me problems, because you control with the left stick forward, sideways, turn left and right, but there are tank controls, and you don't really strafe the way that you would in the first person shooter. You know, the right stick will very, I don't know if it's a sensitivity issue, but it will make you roll left and right very quickly, and it doesn't really work. So yeah, so I was having trouble with that, and like I was trying to kind of steer also with the movement, but when you use the motion controls, it really only moves your shooting, and it doesn't seem to influence in any way where you're going. And so that's kind of that's very, very unintuitive. And so I struggle with that a lot. And by the time I made it to the Titania level, I was just like, I became a freaking like Wii commercial. You know, my living room is not all white, but I was just swinging that gamepad left and right, and I got to the boss, and it becomes all the bosses are in all range mode, and I was just, I got up and I tried to move around, kind of circle around the boss, and I tried to move the turret to keep a beat on him, but then the turret, even though you're playing as the tank, the turret doesn't rotate 360 degrees, so I got up for nothing, and I was just like a Wii commercial, except I was sweating and being way more profane. So it was not a good experience. But then it got a little bit better, you know, more R-Wing stages and stuff like that. And then you get to the final boss, and it is, everyone I've seen on Twitter has complained about it because he's so freaking hard. That's the standard Andross boss, but this time he's in a kind of cylinder. He's in a cylinder kind of shield, and so you go around and you're trying to find where you can enter, and the entrances are only visible on the gamepad. So you see your ship in third person on the TV screen, but that's useless. You have to look at your first person view. And because there's like, he's shooting stuff at you, and it's really, you know, like you have more than one thing to pay attention to. Oftentimes, like you're kind of, always parallel to the cylinder. So once you do find the opening, usually you'll kind of like scrape against the shield because it's hard, you know, like you try to kind of very sharply turn into the cylinder. And then from there, like you turn automatically into the chicken walker. You try to shoot his hands. I tried shooting his eyes, and even though it looked like they were reacting, it did not do the Star Fox 64 thing of actually buying you some time to shoot at the hands. So, I don't know. Like, I went through the game the first time, and I was, you know, I was like, well, okay, this game had some high highs and some levels that were more fun than the N64 game, but I don't feel too good about these low lows, you know? But then I kept playing, and I went and I tried to go after medals, and I tried to open up some of the secret stages. And you know what? Like, I went through the Titania stage over and over again to get all the medals. And by the end of it, I was not swinging the gamepad around anymore. And I was kind of feeling much better about that level. And, you know, I made a point of replaying that one first because it's the one that was just a nightmare the first time around. And, you know, like you go through it a couple of times, you learn the level, you get used to the controls, and all of a sudden kind of the issues that you had fade away, and you're having fun, you know? So that was encouraging. So I keep opening up new levels. I keep going back to the levels that I actually liked playing the first time around. And, I'm a convert. Like, this is a really, really good Star Fox game. And I would say that's probably like the best one so far. But then again, you know, kind of a disclaimer, I did not own an N64. I rented the game a couple of times with the console back in the day, and I probably played through it once or twice back in the day. But most of my experience with the game has been with a remake on 3DS, with the Wii U, the Wii Virtual Console version, and I did not pour the time into it that the people who got medals and unlocked like the cool pair of shades put into. So so I don't have that kind of nostalgic feeling for the N64 game, but still, you know, I played the N64 game, I played the Super Nintendo game, I played the Star Fox Assault. It's kind of a blur because I went through it on a rental and forgot about it. I played all of them. I played the what's it called now? Not Armada Assault.
Command?
Command. Yeah, I've played Command.
Adventure?
And, I did not finish Adventure. Let's
not get Prince Tricky back in.
But yeah, like, you know, like I remember the GameCube version. I had issues with the controls, with the kind of third person on foot segments, but also the flying. I remember kind of feeling like it did not really feel right. Star Fox Command did feel right. Even though you were playing with the touch screen, but levels were so freaking boring that there was, you know, like you could fly around, but that was basically the extent of it. It was not that much fun.
It was all range, essentially.
Yeah. Yeah, and not good all range. Like mostly you just shoot the one type of enemy all over the map, and then you go to the next screen where it's going to be either the same type of enemy again or a different one.
And then you meet Slippy's girlfriend.
Yeah. Yeah. But, yeah, so, you know, And what I'm saying now, like, kind of downplays the statement, like, this is the best Star Fox game. But, Jesus, this is the best Star Fox game. I really, really, I really enjoy it. I really, really enjoy playing this game. It really, you know, it does feel like the Star Fox, like, definitely, like, the flying controls feel like Star Fox. They feel good. And the level design in the corridor sections also feel like Star Fox. But the all-range stuff has been expanded so much that it feels much less like the NC4 game, which were, you know, the all-range levels were very, very basic.
And
usually
small.
And it feels more like a Rogue Squadron game, I would say. Like, many times, my mind went back to Rogue Squadron, because when you're flying around and you're shooting and your aiming is decoupled from steering, you can, like, one of the first things that the game has you do on Corneria in the all-range mode is to fly around and shoot down, aim the gamepad down, and that kind of simulates, that's very close to what you do when you're playing as a Y-Wing in a Rogue Squadron game. Like,
bombing.
You're bombing. Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, I don't know. I like that. I like the bombing runs in those games. And, it feels good in this game too. But that's kind of basic stuff. After that, I was still kind of playing the game, like I would a Star Fox game, like aiming where I'm going, shooting in front of me, and kind of, breaking away when the enemy telegraphs that it's gonna shoot a big laser at me. But eventually you unlock, like, certain, special stages where the previous, like, it's gonna be a slightly different version. They reuse a lot of bosses. Okay. But this boss that you used to beat and that you kind of brute forced and kind of phased head on and then steered away when it was shooting at you, all of a sudden, like, he's got an electromagnetic pulse kind of thing that makes it so that if you just fly towards the center of it, towards the enemy, you're going to regret it, because your ship is going to get, you know, hit by this wave, and it just doesn't work. You're not going to be facing where you're shooting long enough to actually do much damage. And it's going to, you know, like the target time for a gold medal for that stage might be 2 minutes, and it's going to take you 5, 6, 7 to finish it, because, or if you finish it at all, because, you know, you're probably going to crash into that field and die. But, eventually you learn, like, okay, there's no enemies around, other than this big boss. So what I'm going to do is I'm actually going to try to circle around it. And aim with the gamepad and shoot from afar, and it works, and it feels good, you know? Like, it really... And then the game, again, you know, you knock a new stage, and the game pushes that a little bit further, and then you're also facing enemies, and you can't just circle around. You're trying to take out these turrets on this big kind of Imperial Star Destroyer kind of thing. And then you have to weave through turrets, you have to weave through lasers, you have to pay attention to you have to take care of these enemies that are flying all around you. And that's a real test. And again, like, the game tells you, well, you should be able to take out these 14 turrets in a minute and 45 seconds. And, you know, for the first 4 or 5 tries, you can't get down below 4 minutes, and you're like, fuck you, game. I'm gonna buy, if I'm supposed to unlock the classic Super Nintendo our wing by getting 70 medals, like all the medals in the game. Like, fuck that. I'm going to go buy the amiibo. But then,
that's,
you know, like you chip
you.
It away. Yeah, no, but but then you keep going, and like you're all of a sudden, like you start getting it, and like, oh, okay, like I should be playing way more defensively. I should be barrel rolling through this level, really. And there's a big hint that that's what you should do, that I don't want to spoil. But, and then, you know, like, oh, okay, so I did it in 2 minutes and a half, and then 2 minutes, and like, oh, I'm really close. And then you do it, and it feels good. It feels a real reward, really rewarding, you know. It feels like you went through something, and you worked at it, and you played a fun stage, and you got good at it. So I'm just, I don't know, I'm a convert, you know. And before the game came out, before I got my copy, I was saying, like, oh, it's so dumb that you're piloting the ship, and like a second person really should be manning the turret or whatever it is, because that's how it works on actual, you know.
On like actual anthropomorphic fighter planes, yes.
No, but, you know, like if you've got a battleship or something, like the guy on the side of the boat with the cannon is not steering the ship, right? So,
right.
Anyway, but then, and so I was kind of pushing back because Neil in his review really liked it, and he was defending the controls, and I was just like, well, I'm going to try to like it despite the controls. I'm still buying this game, but like, how good can it feel, really? And then I finished the game, and I was like, yeah, okay, I enjoyed this game, but I don't have to eat crow here because I still don't like these controls. And at this point, I'm firmly used to the controls, and I even love them, and I have to eat crow. And Neil was right.
No, you don't. Never, never admit you're wrong, Guillaume.
Ah,
never, but, ever admit you're wrong.
Yeah, no, it's good, and it feels like I was trying to remember exactly, because this idea of playing a 3D flying game where the aiming is decoupled from your steering, like, it didn't feel completely new to me. And I was trying to think of other games that might do this, and I was thinking of like mech combat games, but I've never really played those, so it couldn't have been that. But then I remembered Metroid Blast in Nintendo Land. And so the ship controls in that minigame kind of give you a pretty good idea of what it's like to play Star Fox Zero.
Hmm.
Except that in that game, you're also, you're controlling when you're moving forward, and, you know, whereas
it's
in
more
Star
of
Fox
a hover
Zero,
mode thing. Yeah.
Yeah. Like yeah. Yeah.
Right.
But still, it's kind of gives you it gives you an idea of what it's like to play this game. But
okay.
Yeah, like I fucking live it. It's
so
awesome.
You're a believer, huh? So you're a believer.
Yeah, that's a full-throated recommendation. I mean, I've heard from several people who enjoyed the game and are defending it against some of the criticisms. We're just saying, just offering a different opinion, I guess. It does
people
seem to
have
be
heard
kind of
the other
divisive.
Opinion, though.
Right,
like,
right,
I feel
right.
Like
no,
the controls have gotten a lot of bad press, and I understand. And I can't even, you know, guarantee that to anyone that they're going to eventually love the controls, because I've seen it. Like, I've seen on message boards, like, I can understand if you're a reviewer and you get this game and you're not totally invested, you know, in like, in learning the controls, or you're not like, it might not be worth your time. You've got other stuff to do. You've got other games to play, and you might be like, okay, like I finished this game once. It's enough. I'm going to review it, and I don't really want to go back to it. In my case, I went back to it after I finished it, and it took a while, you know, like it took a few hours before the controls started feeling good. And I've seen some people on message boards, you know, and I trust that, you know, they paid money for the game. I'm sure they didn't go into it wanting to bash it, but I've seen some people really like, oh, wow, I can't get into this. I'm really struggling. And I've seen other people who had never even picked up a Star Fox game, and they were like, yeah, I don't know what people are talking about. This, you know, I took to it right away. So it's really like, it's kind of a crapshoot. Like the only thing I can say is perhaps like read the manual, because it does give you some tips that the game kind of gives you while you're playing, but you're probably not going to notice it because you've got quite a lot in your hands already, you know, like the chicken walker. What makes you, What makes it actually work during boss fights is that you can actually Z-target. You hold down the ZL button, and you lock on, and you can strafe all you want, and it's a freaking Metroid Prime kind of control, you know, with the added motion aiming thing.
So, and a first-person view on the gamepad.
Yeah. So, you know, like, and all of a sudden, you know, like, when you don't know it, or when you miss that information the first time around, it makes the game a whole lot more frustrating than it needs to be. So I guess the game could have done more to force tutorials at you, but would that make a better experience? I don't know. Like I usually rail against forced tutorials because let me play the game, right? It's not the first video game that I've played, but then it turns out that in certain cases like this one, it really helps to go through them and to read the information in the manual.
And, RTFM,
yeah. Just read the instructions.
Yep.
There we go.
I think I'm super glad you like it, dude. And it definitely makes me reconsider, you know, whether I should give it a shot. But I don't know. I will also say I think it's a very weird decision to go with this. And for me, the idea of trying to fly a spaceship while looking at a completely different screen and dealing with a totally different task and in a different perspective, that is what really turns me off of it. It's not the motion control. It's not, you know, transformations and this other stuff. It's the feeling that I have, you know, the very important work of steering this thing and making it not crash into objects. Yeah. I have to just kind of hope that there's not even like really an autopilot, even with Z targeting, that's not really an autopilot thing. So I don't like the idea of just kind of taking my eyes off of the forward motion and dealing with these other tasks. I mean, I've been involved with actual spaceship user interface design, and I can tell you it's very important that you put the controls and all the other features and all the alerts and everything that person needs to know and needs to do, that you put them all very close to the area where you want their eyes to be focused.
Okay, so I'm a big believer in automated cameras. Like, even in like 3D platformers or whatever, like, if I love Super Mario Galaxy for the fact that you can most of the time just rely on the automatic camera, and I'm right there with you. Like, I'd rather the game gave me the optimal angle for the action at all times and me not having to worry about it. But still, the whole dividing your attention, like going back and forth between one screen and the next thing, doesn't really happen all that much. I think what they should have done really is to automate that stuff and give you, sometimes the first person view and then sometimes the third person view when you need it.
Well, can I also say I'm not interested in playing Star Fox from a first person view, even for part of it.
Yeah.
Like, I don't know what's appealing about that. I think you could do that in some of the older games and it wasn't fun there either. You're just painting a cursor around. Like it's you're not really flying the ship anymore at that point. It's just sort of turned into target practice. I don't know, that doesn't have anything to do with what I like about Star Fox.
I will say I actually liked playing those games in first person mode personally.
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah, I did.
Okay.
I mean, so I have the spatial awareness though to know where my ship is. Hmm. So like in my head, I could translate what I'm seeing to the shape of my ship and avoid all the obstacles. Hmm. It gave me more of a targeting window to look through and see. Okay, the enemies are directly in front of me. My ship's not blocking my view. I know where they are. I can deal with this.
Yeah, and what I was gonna say is that it kind of depends. Like, and depending on the situation, you're gonna find something that's gonna work for you, or that's gonna work better for that level. And all of a sudden, the interface kind of you can forget about it a little bit. You know, like the big boss that I described earlier, where you have to circle around and shoot from afar because of the electromagnetic pulse. At that point, it kind of feels like using the cables in a like Shadow of the Empire or Rogue Squadron game, you know, against AT-ATs.
Cables, yeah.
And you know, or for the kind of the Star Destroyer thing, I was very much using first person, so I pressed select, and then the first person view was actually on the TV, and that's how I got through that level, because it was just much better, it was easier to shoot down these turrets from that angle. But again, I don't have anything against the first person view.
I am curious about something you said. I didn't realize that you can push the minus button to flip the screens.
Yeah, you can do that. As far as I can tell, you can do it all the time, except for sometimes when the game has like this kind of cinematic cutscene where it shows you, like, look at these spider bots coming out of these spider boxes. So, yeah, you know, these containers. So, like, it will draw your attention to that, and then it yields the controls back to you. That might be the only time.
Very platinum-y there in a lot of ways. Like, oh, yeah. That's some wonderful one-on-one stuff that you're describing now.
But it seems like that might allow you to play the game entirely on either the TV or the gamepad and just use that button to flip back and forth a lot.
Yeah.
All right. So I was going to spend some real time getting into Bravely Second. I had relatively early impressions last week. I spoke a lot about how they built a demo that I thought was fairly impressive and the challenge of producing a direct sequel to a JRPG. We had gotten an email a little while ago now that basically asked, we do a lot of JRPGs, especially on 3DS, and we talk about the opening 5 or 6 hours, and then we don't come back until maybe at the very end to go, yeah, I finished it. It was good. There is a drive as somebody who does this show every week to have something new to talk about. And ultimately, that is the reason why that happens. So I wanted to make a concerted effort to talk about the game. We're a little tight on time, so I'm going to have to be kind of brief.
Well, you kind of exhausted your RPG quota already. But finally, we got your opinion on Xenoblade. So that's good.
To be fair, we were having a conversation, Guillaume.
I think I have to take the blame on that one.
Yeah, but I want to talk a little bit about a bunch of things. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to really focus on two right now, and I'll talk a little bit more about Bravely Second next week. I'll have beaten the game by then, so I'll be in a good place to talk about it. I was at 5 hours a week ago today. I'm at 37 now, and that's a lot of time to put into a game. But part of the reason, and this is one of the things I want to talk about, is Square Enix is just pushing stuff into this game. Somebody tweeted me today that the game feels a little bit trollish and accusing me of giving Square Enix the idea of people are sick of visiting these same towns over and over again. What should we do for the sequel? And the response is, how about we have them visit these towns again? And sure enough, you do a lot of that. And so far as in the first game, you had this like weird, like, Simpsons tapped out thing where you allocated resources and a clock ticked down to rebuild Narende, which was this town in the game. The same mechanic shows up in this game because they had already built the mechanic and it was going in. What's funny to me is they also added another kind of like, I'm not sure what you'd call those kinds of games, like non-games, idle plays, whatever terminology you want to use. Timer-based games.
Just sort of a resource manager.
Even that, it's mostly just like queue something up and then walk away. So like I've cleared it now. I've rebuilt everything.
Yeah.
But mostly because I just, you know, I queue them up before I go to bed. I queue them before I go to work. I make sure that it's got the right time queued up. It's all, but yeah. They added it's essentially a cookie clicker into this game. I don't know. It's there. You're building your
party.
That's
the real end layer.
Yeah, that's the end. Your party goes inside of a tent, and they produce stuffed creatures called chomps, which are just these stuffed like spheres with feet and big teeth. And you buy upgrades that give them temporary boosts, like they produce more chomps per turn. Their turns go faster. It's bizarre. And the only thing you do is you watch, and you periodically use the upgrades, and you clear out their sold bin. And the game is totally idle. In fact, so much so, it's got the full like soundtrack list for the game in there, and you unlock it as you go, and you can turn the sound effects off. So really, it becomes a visualizer at that point. It's a weird thing they put in this game, and I don't understand why it's there. But I've spent way too much time just doing it while TV was going. But the other thing I want to talk about, and I touched on this a bit last week, and I've kind of had more full thoughts on it. Creating a sequel is really hard, and I'm seeing it now the deeper I get into this game. I've had weird flashbacks to there's two games, Tales of Symphonia, Dawn of the New World, which is a game where building a story on top of another JRPG story completely failed, because not only is Emil and Marta, I think those are the main characters of that game, they're kind of like wish fulfillment characters created by the authors of the first game, because they have to create characters they think are cooler than the ones you already liked. They get ended up being way worse as a result. Like, that's the problem. Like, they're trying to create, like, well, we've already created these characters. What do we do to top those guys? Like, we're not going to give you Lloyd again. He's a world killer. So what do we do? Well, we'll give you Emil. He'll be great. And you're like, no, Emil's fucking trash. He's trash. And in this game, you have Yu. And Yu's not Emil. He's not that terrible. But he's kind of like, they had to do something with him. So they kind of made him this weird fanboy.
Yu-Y-E-W?
Yeah, Y-E-W.
Wasn't that the sage in the first game?
Something similar, at the very least, yeah. Hmm. And the thing is, like, they replaced... They dropped, essentially, two of the comedic characters. So, Ringabel's gone. And, essentially, Anyaz isn't around. So, you've got Edia and you've got Tiz. Tiz isn't really a funny character. He's just kind of, he was there to be the foil for everybody else's stupidity. And now they've got Yu, who's also the foil for everybody else's stupidity. So it's like, well, nobody's being dumb anymore, but you've got all these foils for the dumb people, so that doesn't work out so great. But on top of that, they've made this game, you could tell, not on the cheap, but like they reused a lot of stuff. And the way they just sort of work it is like they just kind of take you from play. It's like, almost like you're getting the half of the main characters of the first game giving you a guided tour of Luxendark. Like, oh yeah, and we were here, they were having this festival, and then the party that's new is like, tell us about the festival, and then the game goes to black because you should already know about the festival, you played the last game, and then it comes back and like, wow, I would have loved to have done that. It's a really weird thing. Like, it feels almost like DLC. Like they just, you should already know about this. The main characters aren't going to bother to explain it, but all these other characters that are new need to hear about it, so they're going to tell them off screen. It's an odd experience. Like, there's a lot of times where I'm going like, wait, did that character know this other thing? Let me go back and check, because it seems like they're referencing, oh, they did know. Okay, that makes sense. It's a very strange experience of a game for that. And the other game that it kind of reminds me of is Baten Kaitos Origins, which handles it the opposite way. It's a lot easier to handle this if you just go in the past, because none of the events of the previous game matter at that point. You just have to make sure your end point is dovetails into the start point. And I have a lot of respect now for anybody who tries to make a JRPG sequel, because I see how friggin' hard it is. Because, I mean, essentially, you've got heroes that are walking around, and people are like, hey, you're the person who saved the world. And they're like, yeah, we're having a hard time killing these ants. There's a lot of ants outside. They're a real pain in the butt.
I think the solution is dress spheres.
Yeah. Well, I mean, ultimately, it could just be hats. You could just give them... I know you're talking about Final Fantasy II, X2, but what a strange experience. Like, I don't know... I didn't really think about making a sequel to a JRPG would be hard before. And, like, now, like, immediately, I understand why it never happens. I'd kind of come around to that point last week, but now that we've basically gone through all of Luxendark for about 40 hours, and it's pretty much just, like, them going to this place where other event in last game happened, and Tiz and Edia kind of, like, reminiscing about it and maybe running into somebody they knew, it's weird. And the fact that the game gives you all new classes and doesn't give you the old ones, at least not immediately, it's kind of strange. And like, they wanted to do new things with the classes, so the classes are more out there. You get stuff like the Catmancer or the Patissier, who makes pastries as a weapon. It's very odd. And then you basically get these kinds of like, hey, remember these jokers from the last game? They were the asterisk holders from them. Here's two of them, and they're having a really piddly conflict about something inconsequential. Pick one and fight them for that one particular class. You don't get both. It's a weird thing. Like, they wanted to separate it where they could, but they were sort of hamstrung by the fact they were A, making a sequel, and B, they probably wanted to turn around it quick, and C, there are probably budgetary constraints in play. It's like, I'm still enjoying the game, but it's giving me kind of like a weird experience of what the game designers were going for and what they were having to tackle. And it does kind of sometimes jump out at you as like, oh, this really is like we needed to make a sequel because this game blew our expectations out of the water. I'll talk a little bit more about the gameplay changes they've made, because there's a handful of smart changes that have come into play. But again, we're time constrained here. I do want to mention one thing, though. Whoever localized this game and was really in love with the fact that the generic enemies in this game are called balls. I just want to make balls jokes. You're a monster. If you're listening to this right now, I want you to go look in the mirror and think about what you did. Because the fact that the party refers to themselves as the ball busters for an extended period of time is just truly unacceptable. Like, in ways that are just... There's a 5-minute conversation where the word balls is used about 15 times. And it's like, I can't deal with this right now. You need to stop this. But, you know, it's still a good game. I've dumped 30 hours in a week. Obviously, I'm enjoying it. But there is this weird, like, because this is such a sequel, it feels tied down in ways beyond just cost control that I didn't expect. And, you know, I'm excited to see what this team does next. But the mentality of this game, the design of this game, like, it all just sort of works for me in a way that I really like. And it does lend itself really well to being a mobile game, not mobile, a handheld game. And it's a good, solid experience. And I'm pleased to see that they've, Silicon Studios, I think, was the company that made these games. Yeah. And like, they made 3D Dot Heroes. Like, but these are like really, really strong games that they did a really nice job with. And I'm excited to see what they do next.
They should do another 3D Dot Game Heroes, but for 3DS.
Well, I don't know that anybody's going to start 3DS projects right now, but it would be really cool to see them. I think their partnership with Square Enix works out well for them, and I would like to see them get the chance to do something else for them, but yeah, not a direct sequel to Bravely Second, Third.
I've talked about Bravely Second a little bit elsewhere, and I won't repeat myself here, but I played through the demo as well, and it kind of told me everything I needed to know about it, which is that this is more Bravely Default. And speaking as someone who finished the first game, I can say that I have played more than enough Bravely Default, and I do not need to go pay them $40 to play more Bravely Default. So if they just made more Bravely Default, I'm good.
Yeah, and speaking as someone who played half of Bravely Default, I can say I've also played enough of Bravely Default.
Yeah.
I was there until I played the demo of this game. Like, I wasn't super excited, and I just liked the demo. I just really did. Like, I liked the fact that they built... And I talked about this. I liked it being a fully contained thing. Like, that was a neat touch, and it told its own little short story. And like, the mechanics of the Bravely games, I really like. And Bravely Default just pissed me off at the end. And you know, the promise that Bravely Second doesn't do that. All right, I'll do this, and yeah, I'll be done with this game next week, and I'll have played Star Fox 2, and I'll be happy.
Week planned.
I'm ready for them to do a little bit more. So, yeah, we're ready. You know, I'm gonna finish this thing off, and I'm gonna do it.
Okay.
But on that, Johnny, I want to thank you for being here this week.
Oh, it was my sincere pleasure, and I appreciate the invitation. Absolutely, love talking with you guys. I'm sorry I missed John and Greg, but we'll do it another time, I'm sure.
I don't know if there was space for them, really.
It's true. We filled up a show with three people.
You know, I answered the call of duty.
It's true. Johnny, do you have anything you wanted to plug?
I do. Thank you, James. Hopefully longtime listeners will know that they can hear me every couple weeks talking about movies on a show called Box Office Poison. My music podcast is on an extended hiatus, but I do hope to bring that back sometime. The last one... if you haven't heard it, the last episode I did was recorded during a cross-country move not terribly long after I left RFN. which was somewhat related to me leaving RFN, I suppose. But I recorded an episode. I recorded a podcast with my dad in the car on the interstate. I believe we were in Oklahoma at the time, maybe. It's me and my dad talking about Elvis in the car. And, yeah, it was a special experience. Keep in mind, my dad literally does not know what a podcast is and still doesn't. So, I would recommend checking that out.
It's been a long time since we did a car podcast.
Yeah, for good reason.
It was like E309. I think we did one.
They don't sound
not
good.
More E3 reminiscence, please.
No, yeah, I'm just saying, they sound really bad.
They're hard to make. But the main thing I wanted to plug is that I was cajoled into co-founding a new video game podcast. And not to compete with RFN by any means, and it's something totally different. And actually, my participation was leveraged heavily upon the idea that I would have to do basically no work, and I would show up and gab with my friends and then walk away from it, and then a show would appear later. So that's the only reason I agreed to do it at all. But it's called Austin Mates, or Aust Inmates, or Austin Mates, which is, that's my favorite version. But it's some old friends of mine who I grew up playing video games with, and fortuitously we now all live in Austin, so we have been reconnecting and getting back together, and it turns out that we still all love video games, which is what we bonded over in the first place when we were like 4 or 5 years old. And so it's been a lot of fun to chat with them and to play games with them. We did a live stream where we played through the entirety of Mylan's Secret Castle together, collaboratively, and they were converted. Once they kind of saw what that game has to offer, they kind of got into it and were really interested by it. And my friend actually was the one who beat it. So anyway, that's on YouTube. It's around if you want to watch that. But more importantly, if you are subscribed to Crosstalk, the Crosstalk feed, you'll get Austin Mates. But if you're not, you should check it out. I think if you search for Crosstalk with a W on iTunes, or maybe if you search for Austin Mates, all one word, you might find it that way too. But hey, it's comes out once or twice a month, and it's very casual. We just sit around in a room, and we're drunk or whatever, and it's fun. It's very different from RFN, but it's fun.
Yo, I'm going to need you to cut that whole segment out.
Yeah, sure.
The whole thing's got to go. All right, excellent.
Unfaithful.
We can't have this here. God damn it, Johnny. You handed me the show. I'm not going to let you come back and do this to me. I will ruin this show on my own. Thank you. And if you want to tell me how I'm ruining it, or just send us a question about the cataclysm that was the events described in the first segment, you can email us at rfn@nintendoworldreport.com. We will quite likely read your email on the show, or one similar, and proceed to talk about ZX Spectrum conversions of arcade games instead, as we did last week. I apologize again for that that digression. But when John's not here, your chances are better, so maybe he'll grow his playoff beard and forget to come to the show. But on that, that's going to do it for us this week. I want to thank you all for listening. Thanks, Guillaume and Johnny, for being here. No thanks to Greg and John for bailing on us. I'll never forgive you. As for our retroactive, the voting is closed as of the time you are hearing this. And the winner is Castlevania Rondo of Blood. So get out your turbo CDs, because it's time to play the most Japanese of Castlevania games. We will be doing it no sooner than 2 weeks from next week, so that will make it 477. But we will announce next week the timeline for the next retroactive. And on that, this week, your end music is the Return to Corneria theme from Star Fox Zero, as selected by our very own, but now not here, Mr. Greg Leahy. Bye, everybody.
Well, I second the pick, anyway.
Well, that's fine. It was gonna be freaking Baby Bird, but I keep getting overridden by the fact you've already used that song, and it's terrible. Well, fine. Star Fox Zero. Bye, everybody.
Bye.
Adios.